or were oozing out of the buildings on either side of the street. It was as thick as a man's arm now. Cloud whickered and tried to back further away as Egwene and Tom and the others came upon him. Their horses, too, tossed their heads and bridled against coming too near the fog. Lan and Moraine rode slowly toward the fog, grown to as big around as a leg, stopping on the other side, well back. The Aes Sedai studied the branch of mist that separated them. Rand shrugged at a sudden itch of fear between his shoulder blades. A faint light accompanied the fog, growing as the foggy tentacle became fatter, but still only a little more than the moonlight. The horses shifted uneasily, even Aldeeb and Mondarb.
"What is it?" Nynaeve asked.
"The evil of Shadar Logoth," Moraine replied. "Mashadar. Unseeing, unthinking, moving through the city as aimlessly as a worm burrows through the earth. If it touches you, you will die."
Rand and the others let their horses dance a few quick steps back, but not too far. As much as Rand would have given to be free of the Aes Sedai, she was as safe as home compared to what lay around them.
"Then how do we join you?"
Egwene said.
"Can you kill it? Clear away?"
Moraine's laughter was bitter and short.
"Mashadar is vast, girl, as vast as Shadar Logoth itself. The whole White Tower could not kill it. If I damaged it enough to let you pass, drawing that much the one power would pull the Halfmen like a trumpet call. And Mashadar would rush in to heal whatever harm I did. Rush in and perhaps catch us in its net."
Rand exchanged looks with Egwene, then asked her question again. Moraine sighed before answering.
"I do not like it, but what must be done must be done. This thing will not be above ground everywhere. Other streets will be clear. See that star?"
She twisted in her saddle to point to a red star low in the eastern sky.
"Keep on toward that star, and it will bring you to the river. Whatever happens, keep moving toward the river. Go as quickly as you can. But above all, make no noise. There are still the Trollocs, remember? And 4 half-men."
"But how will we find you again?"
Egwene protested.
"I will find you," Moraine said. "Be assured I can find you. Now be off. This thing is utterly mindless, but it can sense food."
Indeed, ropes of silver gray had lifted from the larger body. They drifted, wavering, like the tentacles of 100 arms in the bottom of a waterwood pond. When Rand looked up from the thick trunk of opaque mist, the water and the Aes Sedai were gone. He licked his lips and met his companion's eyes. They were as nervous as he was, and something worse. They all seemed to be waiting for someone else to move first. Night and ruins surrounded them. The Fades were out there, somewhere, and the Trollocs, maybe around the next corner. The tentacles of fog drifted nearer, halfway to them now, and no longer wavering. They had chosen their intended prey. Suddenly he missed Moraine very much. Everyone was still staring, wondering which way to go. He turned Cloud, and the gray broke into a half-trot, tugging against the reins to go faster. As if moving first had made him the leader, everyone followed. With Moraine gone, there was no one to protect them should Mordoth appear, and the Trollocs, and... Rand forced himself to stop thinking. He would follow the Red Star. He could hold on to that thought. 3 times they had to backtrack from a street blocked from side to side by a hill of stone and brick the horses could never have crossed. Rand could hear the others breathing short and sharp, just shy of panic. He gritted his teeth to stop his own panting.
"You have to at least make them think you're not afraid. You're doing a good job, Woolhead. You'll get everybody out safely."
They rounded the next corner. A wall of fog bathed the broken pavement with a light as bright as a full moon. Streamers as thick as their horses broke off toward them. Nobody waited. Wheeling, they galloped away in a tight knot with no heed for the clatter of their hooves they raised. 2 Trollocs stepped into the street before them, not 10 spans away. For an instant, the humans and the Trollocs just stared at one another, each more surprised than the other. Another pair of Trollocs appeared, and another, colliding with the ones in front, folding into a shocked mass at the sight of the humans. Only for an instant did they remain frozen, though. Guttural howls echoed from the buildings, and the Trollocs bounded forward. The humans scattered like quail. Rands Gray reached full gallop in three strides. "This way!" he shouted, but he heard the same cry from five throats. A hasty glance over his shoulder showed him his companions disappearing in as many directions, Trollocs pursuing them all. Three Trollocs ran at his own heels, catchpoles waving in the air. His skin crawled as he realized they were matching Cloud stride for stride. He dropped low on Cloud's neck and urged the Gray on, chased by thick cries. The street narrowed ahead, broken-topped buildings leaning out drunkenly. Slowly the empty windows filled with a silvery glow, a dense mist bulging outward. Mashadar. Rand risked a glance over his shoulder. The Trollocs still ran less than 50 paces back. The light from the fog was enough to see them clearly. A fade rode behind them now, and they seemed to flee the half-man as much as to pursue Rand. Ahead of Rand, half a dozen gray tendrils wavered from the windows, a dozen feeling the air. Cloud tossed his head and screamed, but Rand dug his heels in brutally and the horse lunged forward wildly. The tendrils stiffened as Rand galloped between them, but he crouched low on Cloud's neck and refused to look at them. The way beyond was clear. "If one of them touches me, light." He booted Cloud harder, and the horse leaped forward into the welcome shadows. With Cloud still running, he looked back as soon as the glow of Mashadar began to lessen. The waving gray tentacles of Mashadar blocked half the street, and the Trollocs were balking, but the Fade snatched a whip from its saddle bow, cracking it over the heads of the Trollocs with a sound like a lightning bolt, popping sparks in the air. Crouching, the Trollocs lurched after Rand. The half-man hesitated, black cowl studying Mashadar's reaching arms, before it, too, spurred forward. The thickening tentacles of fog swung uncertainly for a moment, then struck like vipers. At least two attached to each Trolloc, bathing them in gray light. Muzzled heads went back to scream, but fog rolled over open mouths and in, eating the howls. Four leg-thick tentacles whipped around the Fade, and the half-man and its black horse twitched as if dancing till the cowl fell back, bearing that pale eyeless face. The Fade shrieked. There was no sound from that cry, any more than from the Trollocs. But something came through, a piercing whine just beyond hearing, like all the hornets in the world digging into Rand's ears with all the fear that could exist. Cloud convulsed as if he too heard, and ran harder than ever. Rand hung on, panting, his throat as dry as sand. After a time he realized he could no longer hear the silent shriek of the Fade dying, and suddenly the clatter of his gallop seemed as loud as shouts. He reined Cloud hard, stopping beside a jagged wall, right where two streets met. A nameless monument reared in the darkness before him. Slumped in the saddle, he listened, but there was nothing to hear except the blood pounding in his ears. Cold sweat beaded on his face, and he shivered as the wind flailed his coat. Finally, he straightened. Stars spangled the sky where the clouds did not hide them, but the red star low in the east was easy to mark. Is anybody else alive to see it? Were they free or in the Trolloc's hands? Egwene, light blind me, why didn't you follow me? If they were alive and free, they would be following that star. If not, the ruins were vast. He could search for days without finding anyone, if he could keep away from the Trollocs. And the Fades, and Mordith, and Mashadar. Reluctantly, he decided to make for the river. He gathered the reins. On the crossing street, one stone fell against another with a sharp click. He froze, not even breathing. He was hidden in the shadows, one step from the corner. Frantically, he thought of backing up. What was behind him? What would make a noise and give him away? He could not remember, and he was afraid to take his eyes from the corner of the building. Darkness bulked at that corner, with the longer darkness of a shaft sticking out of it. Catchpole? Even as the thought flashed into Rand's mind, he dug his heels into Cloud's ribs, and his sword flew from the scabbard. A wordless shout accompanied his charge, and he swung the sword with all of his might. Only a desperate effort stopped the blade short. With a yelp, Matt tumbled back, half falling off his horse and nearly dropping his bow.
Rand drew a deep breath and lowered his sword. His arm shook.
"Have you seen anybody else?" he managed.
Matt swallowed hard before pulling himself awkwardly back into his saddle.
I... just the Trollocs.
He put a hand to his throat and licked his lips.
Just Trollocs. You?
Rand shook his head. They must be trying to reach the river. We had better do the same. Matt nodded silently, still feeling his throat, and they started toward the Red Star. Before they had covered 100 spans, the keening cry of a Trolloc horn rose behind them in the depths of the city. Another answered from outside the walls. Rand shivered, but he kept to his slow pace, watching the darkest places and avoiding them when he could. After one jerk at his reins, as if he might gallop off, Matt did the same. Neither horn sounded again, and it was in silence that they came to an opening in the vine-shrouded wall where a gate had once been. Only the towers remained, standing broken-topped against the black sky. Matt hesitated at the gateway, but Rand said softly, "Is it any safer in here than out there?" He did not slow the gray, and after a moment Matt followed him out of Shadar Logoth, trying to look every way at once. Rand let out a slow breath. His mouth was dry.
"We're going to make it. Light, we're going to make it."
The walls vanished behind, swallowed by the night and the forest. Listening for the slightest sound, Rand kept the Red Star dead ahead. Suddenly Tom galloped by from behind, slowing only long enough to shout,
"Ride, you fools!"
A moment later, hunting cries and crashes in the brush behind him announced the presence of Trollocs on his trail. Rand dug in his heels, and Cloud sprang after the Gleeman's gelding.
"What happens when we get to the river without Moraine?" "Light, Egwene."
Perrin sat his horse in the shadows, watching the open gateway, some little distance off yet, and absently ran his thumb along the blade of his axe. It seemed to be a clear way out of the ruined city, but he had sat there for 5 minutes, studying it. The wind tossed his shaggy curls and tried to carry his cloak away, but he pulled the cloak back around him without really noticing what he was doing. He knew that Matt and almost everyone else in Emmonsfield considered him slow of thought. It was partly because he was big and usually moved carefully. He had always been afraid he might accidentally break something or hurt somebody, since he was so much bigger than the boys he grew up with. But he really did prefer to think things all the way through if he could. Quick thinking, careless thinking, had put Matt into hot water one time after another. And Matt's quick thinking usually managed to get Rand or him, or both, in the cook pot alongside Matt, too. His throat tightened.
"Light. Don't think about being in a cook pot."
He tried to order his thoughts again. Careful thought was the way. There had been some sort of square in front of the gate once, with a huge fountain in its middle. Part of the fountain was still there, a cluster of broken statues standing in a big round basin, and so was the open space around it. To reach the gate, he would have to ride nearly 100 spans with only the night to shield him from searching eyes. That was not a pleasant thought, either. He remembered those unseen watchers too well. He considered the horns he had heard in the city a little while earlier. He had almost turned back, thinking some of the others might have been taken, before realizing that he could not do anything alone if they had been captured.
Not against, what did Lan say, 100 Trollocs and 4 Fades? Moraine Sedai said get to the river.
He went back to consideration of the gate. Careful thought had not given him much, but he had made his decision. He rode out of the deeper shadow into the lesser darkness. As he did, another horse appeared from the far side of the square and stopped. He stopped, too, and felt for his axe. It gave him no great sense of comfort.
If that dark shape was a fade...
"Rand?" came a soft, hesitant call. He let out a long, relieved breath.
"It's Perrin, Egwene," he called back, just as softly.
It still sounded too loud in the darkness. The horses came together near the fountain. "Have you seen anybody else?" they both asked at the same time, and both answered by shaking their heads.
"They'll be all right,"
Egwene muttered, patting Bella's neck.
"Won't they?"
"Moraine Sedai and Lan will look after them," Perrin replied. "They will look after all of us once we get to the river." He hoped it was so. He felt a great relief once they were beyond the gate, even if there were Trollocs in the forest. Or Fades. He stopped that line of thought. The bare branches were not enough to keep him from guiding on the Red Star, and they were beyond Mordoth's reach now. That one had frightened him worse than the Trollocs ever had. Soon they would reach the river and meet Moraine, and she would put them beyond the Trollocs' reach as well. He believed it because he needed to believe. The wind scraped branches together and rustled the leaves and needles on the evergreens. A nighthawk's lonely cry drifted in the dark, and he and Egwene moved their horses closer together as though they were huddling for warmth. They were very much alone. A Trolloc horn sounded somewhere behind them, quick, wailing blasts urging the hunters to hurry, hurry. Then thick, half-human howls rose on their tail, spurred on by the horn. Howls that grew sharper as they caught the human scent. Perrin put his horse to a gallop, shouting, "Come on!" Egwene came, both of them booting their horses, heedless of noise, heedless of the branches that slapped at them. As they raced through the trees, guided as much by instinct as by the dim moonlight, Bella fell behind. Perrin looked back. Egwene kicked the mare and flailed her with the reins, but it was doing no good. By their sounds, the Trollocs were coming closer. He drew in enough not to leave her behind.
"Hurry!"
he shouted. He could make out the Trollocs now, huge dark shapes bounding through the trees, bellowing and snarling to chill the blood. He gripped the haft of his axe, hanging at his belt, until his knuckles hurt.
"Hurry, Egwene! Hurry!"
Suddenly his horse screamed and he was falling, tumbling out of the saddle as the horse dropped away beneath him. He flung out his hands to brace himself and splashed headfirst into icy water. He had ridden right off the edge of a sheer bluff into the Arunel. The shock of freezing water ripped a gasp from him, and he swallowed more than a little before he managed to fight his way to the surface. He felt more than heard another splash, and thought that Egwene must have come right after him. Panting and blowing, he treaded water. It was not easy to keep afloat. His coat and cloak were already sodden, and his boots had filled. He looked around for Egwene, but saw only the glint of moonlight on the black water, ruffled by the wind.
"Egwene! Egwene!"
A spear flashed right in front of his eyes and threw water in his face. Others splashed into the river around him, too. Guttural voices raised an argument on the riverbank, and the Trolloc spears stopped coming. But he gave up on calling for the time being. The current washed him downriver, but the thick shouts and snarls followed along the bank, keeping pace. Undoing his cloak, he let the river take it. A little less weight to drag him down. Doggedly, he set out swimming for the far bank. There were no Trollocs there, he hoped. He swam the way they did back home in the ponds in the Waterwood, stroking with both hands, kicking with both feet, keeping his head out of the water. At least he tried to keep his head out of the water. It was not easy. Even without the cloak, his coat and boots each seemed to weigh as much as he did. And the axe dragged at his waist, threatening to roll him over if it did not pull him under. He thought about letting the river have that, too. He thought about it more than once. It would be easy, much easier than struggling out of his boots, for instance. But every time he thought of it, he thought of crawling out on the far bank to find Trollocs waiting. The axe would not do him much good against half a dozen Trollocs, or even against one, maybe. But it was better than his bare hands. After a while, he was not even certain he would be able to lift the axe if Trollocs were there. His arms and legs became leaden. It was an effort to move them, and his face no longer came as far out of the river with each stroke. He coughed from water that went up his nose. "A day at the forge has no odds on this," he thought wearily, and just then his kicking foot struck something. It was not until he kicked it again that he realized what it was. The bottom. He was in the shallows. He was across the river. Sucking air through his mouth, he got to his feet, splashing about as his legs almost gave way. He fumbled his axe out of its loop as he floundered ashore, shivering in the wind. He did not see any Trollocs. He did not see Egwene, either. Just a few scattered trees along the riverbank and a moonlight ribboned on the water. When he had his breath again, he called their names again and again. Faint shouts from the far side answered him. Even at that distance, he could make out the harsh voices of Trollocs. His friends did not answer, though. The wind surged, its moan drowning out the Trollocs, and he shivered. It was not cold enough to freeze the water soaking his clothes, but it felt as if it was. It sliced to the bone with an icy blade. Hugging himself was only a gesture that did not stop the shivering. Alone, he climbed tiredly up the riverbank to find shelter against the wind. Rand patted Cloud's neck, soothing the gray with whispers. The horse tossed his head and danced on quick feet. The Trollocs had been left behind, or so it seemed, but Cloud had the smell of them thick in his nostrils. Matt rode with an arrow knocked, watching for surprises out of the night, while Rand and Tom peered through the branches, searching for the red star that was their guide. Keeping it in view had been easy enough, even with all the branches overhead, so long as they were riding straight toward it. But then more Trollocs had appeared ahead, and they went galloping off to the side with both packs howling after them. The Trollocs could keep up with a horse, but only for 100 paces or so, and finally they left the pursuit and the howls behind. But with all the twists and turns, they had lost the guiding star.
"I still say it's over there," Matt said, gesturing off to his right. "We were going north at the end, and that means east is that way."
"There it is," Tom said abruptly.
He pointed through the tangled branches to their left, straight at the red star. Matt mumbled something under his breath. Out of the corner of his eye, Rand caught the movement as a Trolloc leaped out from behind a tree without a sound, swinging its catchpole. Rand dug his heels in, and the gray bounded forward just as two more plunged from the shadows after the first. A noose brushed the back of Rand's neck, sending a shiver down his spine. An arrow took one of the bestial faces in the eye, then Matt swung in beside him as their horses pounded through the trees. They were running toward the river, he realized, but he was not sure it was going to do any good. The Trollocs sped after them, almost close enough to reach out and grab the streaming tails of their horses. Half a step gained, and the catchpoles could drag them both out of their saddles. He leaned low on the gray's neck to put that much more distance between his own neck and the nooses. Matt's face was nearly buried in his horse's mane, but Rand wondered where Tom was. Had the gleeman decided he was better off on his own, since all three Trollocs had fastened on the boys? Suddenly Tom's gelding galloped out of the night, hard behind the Trollocs. The Trollocs had only time enough to look back in surprise before the gleeman's hands whipped back and then forward. Moonlight flashed off steel. One Trolloc tumbled forward, rolling over and over before landing in a heap, while a second dropped to its knees with a scream, clawing at its back with both hands. The third snarled, baring a muzzleful of sharp teeth, but as its companions toppled, it whirled away into the darkness. Tom's hand made the whip-like motion again, and the Trolloc shrieked, but the shrieks faded into the distance as it ran. Rand and Matt pulled up and stared at the gleeman.
"My best knives," Tom muttered,
but he made no effort to get down and retrieve them.
"That one will bring others. I hope the river isn't too far. I hope..."
Instead of saying what else he hoped, he shook his head and set off at a quick canter. Rand and Matt fell in behind him. Soon they reached a low bank where trees grew right to the edge of the night-black water, its moon-streaked surface riffled by the wind. Rand could not see the far side at all. He did not like the idea of crossing on a raft in the dark, but he liked the idea of staying on this side even less. "I'll swim if I have to." Somewhere away from the river, a Trolloc horn brayed, sharp, quick, and urgent in the darkness. It was the first sound from the horns since they had left the ruins. Rand wondered if it meant some of the others had been captured.
"No use staying here all night," Tom said. "Pick a direction, upriver or down."
"But Moraine and the others could be anywhere," Matt protested. "Any way we choose could just take us further away."
"So it could."
Clucking to his gelding, Tom turned downriver, heading along the bank.
"So it could."
Rand looked at Matt, who shrugged, and they turned after him. For a time, nothing changed. The bank was higher in some places, lower in others. The trees grew thicker, or thinned out in small clearings, but the night and the river and the wind were all the same, cold and black.
and no Trollocs. That was one change Rand was glad to forego. Then he saw a light ahead, just a single point. As they drew closer, he could see that the light was well above the river, as if it were in a tree. Tom quickened the pace and began to hum under his breath. Finally, they could make out the source of the light, a lantern, hoisted atop one of the masts of a large trader's boat, tied up for the night beside a small clearing in the trees. The boat, a good 80 feet long, shifted slightly with the current, tugging against the mooring ropes tied to trees. The rigging hummed and creaked in the wind. The lantern doubled the moonlight on the deck, but no one was in sight.
"Now that," Tom said as he dismounted, "is better than an Aes Sedai's raft, isn't it?"
He stood with his hands on his hips, and even in the dark his smugness was apparent.
"It doesn't look as if this vessel is made to carry horses, but considering the danger he's in, which we are going to warn him of, the captain may be reasonable. Just let me do all the talking. And bring your blankets and saddlebags, just in case."
Rand climbed down and began untying the things behind his saddle.
"You don't mean to leave without the others, do you?"
Tom had no chance to say what he meant to do. Into the clearing burst two Trollocs, howling and waving their catchpoles, with four more right behind. The horses reared and whinnied. Shouts in the distance said more Trollocs were on the way.
"Onto the boat!" Tom shouted. "Quick! Leave all that! Run!"
Suiting his own words, he ran for the boat, patches flapping and instrument cases on his back banging together.
"You on the boat!" he shouted. "Wake up, you fools! Trollocs!"
Rand jerked his blanket roll and saddlebags free of the last thong and was right on the gleeman's heels. Tossing his burdens over the rail, he vaulted after them. He just had time to see a man curled up on the deck beginning to sit up as if he had only that moment awakened when his feet came down right on top of the fellow. The man grunted loudly. Rand stumbled, and a hooked catchpole slammed into the rail just where he had come over. Shouts rose all over the boat, and feet pounded along the deck. Hairy hands caught the railing beside the catchpole, and a goat-horned head lifted above it. Off balance, stumbling, Rand still managed to draw his sword and swing. With a scream, the Trolloc dropped away. Men ran everywhere on the boat, shouting, hacking mooring lines with axes. The boat lurched and swung as if eager to be off. Up in the bow, three men struggled with the Trolloc. Someone thrust over the side with a spear, though Rand could not see what he was stabbing at. A bowstring snapped and snapped again. The man Rand had stepped on scrabbled away from him on hands and knees, then flung up his hands when he saw Rand looking at him.
"Spare me!" he cried. "Take whatever you want! Take the boat! Take everything, but spare me!"
Suddenly something slammed across Rand's back, smashing him to the deck. His sword skittered away from his outstretched hand. Open-mouthed, gasping for a breath that would not come, he tried to reach the sword. His muscles responded with agonized slowness. He writhed like a slug. The fellow who wanted to be spared gave one frightened, covetous look at the sword, then vanished into the shadows. Painfully, Rand managed to look over his shoulder and knew his luck had run out. A wolf-muzzled Trolloc stood balanced on the railing, staring down at him, holding the splintered end of the catchpole that had knocked the wind out of him. Rand struggled to reach the sword, to move, to get away, but his arms and legs moved jerkily, and only half as he wanted. They wobbled and went in odd directions. His chest felt as if it were strapped with iron bands. Silver spots swam in his eyes. Frantically, he hunted for some way to escape. Time seemed to slow as the Trolloc raised the jagged pole as if to spear him with it. To Rand, the creature appeared to be moving as if in a dream. He watched the thick arm go back. He could already feel the broken haft ripping through his spine, feel the pain of it tearing him open. He thought his lungs would burst.
"I'm going to die. Light, help me, I'm going to—"
The Trolloc's arm started forward, driving the splintered shaft, and Rand found the breath for one yell.
"No!"
Suddenly the ship lurched, and a boom swung out of the shadows to catch the Trolloc across the chest with a crunch of breaking bones, sweeping it over the side. For a moment, Rand lay panting and staring up at the boom swinging back and forth above him. "That has to have used up my luck," he thought. "There can't be any more after that." Shakily he got to his feet and picked up his sword, for once holding it in both hands the way Lan had taught him. But there was nothing left on which to use it. The gap of black water between the boat and the bank was widening quickly. The cries of Trollocs were fading behind in the night. As he sheathed his sword and slumped against the railing, a stocky man in a coat that hung to his knees strode up the deck to glare at him. Long hair that fell to his thick shoulders and a beard that left his upper lip bare framed a round face. Round, but not soft. The boom swung out again, and the bearded man spared part of his glare for that as he caught it. It made a crisp splat against his broad palm.
"Gelb!"
he bellowed.
"Fortune! Where do you be, Gelb?"
He spoke so fast, with all the words running together, that Rand could barely understand him.
"You can no hide from me on my own ship. Get Flor and Gelb out here."
A crewman appeared with a bullseye lantern, and two more pushed a narrow-faced man into the circle of light it cast. Rand recognized the fellow who had offered him the boat. The man's eye shifted from side to side, never meeting those of the stocky man. The captain, Rand thought. A bruise was coming up on Gelb's forehead, where one of Rand's boots had caught him.
"Were you no supposed to secure this boom, Gelb?"
the captain asked with surprising calm, though just as fast as before. Gelb looked truly surprised.
"But I did. Tied it down tight. I admit I'm a little slow about things now and then, Captain Doman, but I get them done."
"So you be slow, do you?
No, so slow at sleeping. Sleeping when you should be standing watch. We could be murdered to a man for all of you." "No, Captain, no. It was him."
Gelb pointed straight at Rand.
"I was on guard, just like I was supposed to be, when he sneaked up and hit me with a club."
He raised the bruise on his head, winced, and glared at Rand.
"I fought him, but then the Trollocs came. He's in league with them, Captain. A dark friend. In league with the Trollocs."
"In league with my aged grandmother,"
Captain Doman roared.
"Did I no warn you the last time, Gelb? At Whitebridge, off you do go. Get out of my sight before I'd put you off now."
Gelb darted out of the lantern light, and Doman stood, opening and closing his hands, while he stared at nothing.
"These Trollocs do be following me. Why will they no leave me be? Why?"
Rand looked over the rail and was shocked to find the riverbank no longer in sight. Two men manned the long steering oar that stuck out over the stern, and there were six sweeps working to a side now, pulling the ship like a water bug further out into the river.
"Captain," Rand said, "we have friends back there. If you go back and pick them up, I am sure they'll reward you."
The captain's round face swung toward Rand, and when Tom and Matt appeared, he included them in his expressionless stare as well.
"Captain," Tom began with a bow,
"allow me to." "You come below,"
Captain Doman said,
"where I can see what manner of thing be hauled up on my deck. Come, fortune desert me. Somebody secure this horn-cursed boom."
As crewmen rushed to take the boom, he stumped off toward the stern of the boat. Rand and his two companions followed. Captain Doman had a tidy cabin in the stern, reached by climbing down a short ladder, where everything gave the impression of being in its proper place, right down to the coats and cloaks hanging from pegs on the back of the door. The cabin stretched the width of the ship, with a broad bed built against one side, and a heavy table built out from the other. There was only one chair, with a high back and sturdy arms, and the captain took that himself, motioning the others to find places on various chests and benches that were the only other furnishings. A loud harumph stopped Matt from sitting on the bed.
"Now,"
said the captain, when they were all seated,
"my name be Bale Doman, captain and owner of the Spray, which be this ship. Now who be you, and where be you going out here in the middle of nowhere? And why should I no throw you over the side for the trouble you've brought me?"
Rand still had as much trouble as before in following Doman's rapid speech. When he worked out the last part of what the captain had said, he blinked in surprise.
"Throw us over the side?"
Matt hurriedly said,
"We didn't mean to cause you any trouble. Run our way to Camelin and then to..."
"And then where the wind takes us," Tom interrupted smoothly. "That's how gleemen travel, like dust on the wind.
I am a gleeman, you understand. Tom Marilyn by name.
He shifted his cloak so the multi-hued patches stirred as if the captain could have missed them.
These two country louts want to become my apprentices, though I am not yet sure I want them.
Rand looked at Matt, who grinned.
That be all very well, man, Captain Doman said placidly. But it tells me nothing. Liss! Fortune prick me! That place be on no road to Canaan from anywhere I ever heard tell of.
Now that is a story, Tom said, and he straightaway began to unfold it.
According to Tom, he had been trapped by the winter snows in a mining town in the mountains of mist beyond Berlon. While there, he heard legends of a treasure dating from the Trolloc Wars, in the lost ruin of a city called Aradhal. Now it just so happened that he had earlier learned the location of Aradhal from a map given him many years ago by a dying friend in Ilion, whose life he had once saved. A man who expired breathing that the map would make Tom rich, which Tom never believed until he heard the legends. When the snows melted enough, he set out with a few companions, including his two would-be apprentices, and after a journey of many hardships, they actually found the ruined city. But it turned out the treasure had belonged to one of the dreadlords themselves, and Trollocs had been sent to fetch it back to Sheol Ghul. Almost every danger they really had faced, Trollocs, Murdrol, Drakkar, Mordith, Mashadar, assailed them at one point or another of the story, though the way Tom told it, they all seemed to be aimed at him personally, and to have been handled by him with the greatest adroitness. With much derring-do, mostly by Tom, they escaped, pursued by Trollocs, though they became separated in the night, until finally Tom and his two companions sought refuge in the last place left to them, Captain Doman's most welcome ship. As the gleeman finished up, Rand realized his mouth had been hanging open for some time, and shut it with a click. When he looked at Matt, his friend was staring wide-eyed at the gleeman. Captain Doman drummed his fingers on the arm of his chair.
That be a tale many folk would no believe. Of course, I did see the Trollocs, did I know?
Every word true, Tom said blandly, from one who lived it.
Happen you have some of this treasure with you?
Tom spread his hands regretfully.
Alas, what little we managed to carry away was with our horses, which bolted when those last Trollocs appeared. All I have left are my flute and my harp, a few coppers and the clothes on my back. But believe me, you want no part of that treasure. It has the taint of the Dark One. Best to leave it to the ruins and the Trollocs. So you've no money to pay your passage. I'd no let my own brother sail with me if he could no pay his passage. Especially if he brought Trollocs behind him to hack up my railings and cut up my rigging. Why should I no let you swim back where you came from and be rid of you?
You wouldn't just put us ashore, Matt said. Not with Trollocs there.
Who said anything about shore?
Doman replied dryly. He studied them a moment, then spread his hands flat on the table.
Bale Doman, be a reasonable man. I'd no toss you over the side if there be a way out of it. Now, I see one of your apprentices has a sword. I need a good sword, and fine fellow that I be, I'll let you have passage far as Whitebridge for it.
Tom opened his mouth, and Rand spoke up quickly.
No!
Tam had not given it to him to trade away. He ran his hand down the hilt, feeling the bronze heron. As long as he had it, it was as if Tam were with him. Doman shook his head.
Well, if it be no, it be no. But Bale Doman no give free passage, not to his own mother.
Reluctantly, Rand emptied his pocket. There was not much, a few coppers, and the silver coin Moraine had given him. He held it out to the captain. After a second, Matt sighed and did the same. Tom glared, but a smile replaced it so quickly that Rand was not sure it had been there at all. Captain Doman deftly plucked the two fat silver coins out of the boy's hands and produced a small set of scales and a clinking bag from a brass-bound chest behind his chair. After careful weighing, he dropped the coins in the bag and returned them each, some smaller silver and copper. Mostly copper.
As far as Whitebridge, he said,
making a neat entry in his leather-bound ledger.
That's a dear passage just to Whitebridge, Tom grumbled.
"'Plus damages to my vessel,' the captain answered placidly. He put the scales and the bag back in the chest and closed it in a satisfied way. "'Plus a bit for bringing Trollocs down on me, so I must run down river in the night, when there be shallows aplenty to pile me up.'
"'What about the others?' Rand said. "'Will you take them, too? They should have reached the river by now. Or they soon will, and they'll see that lantern on your mast.'
Captain Doman's eyebrows rose in surprise.
"'Happen you think we be standing still, man? Fortune prick me, we be 3-4 miles downriver from where you came aboard. Trollocs make those fellows put their backs to the oars. They know Trollocs better than they like. And the current helps, too. But it makes no never mind. I'd no put in again tonight if my old grandmother was on the river bank. I may no put in again at all until I reach Whitebridge. I've had my fill of Trollocs dogging my heels long before tonight.' "'And I'll have no more. Can I help it?'
Tom leaned forward interestedly.
"'You have had encounters with Trollocs before? Lately?'
Doman hesitated, eyeing Tom narrowly, but when he spoke he merely sounded disgusted.
"'I wintered in Saldea, man. Not my choice, but the river froze early, and the ice broke up late. They say you can see the blight from the highest towers in Maradan, but I've no mind for that.' I've been there before, and there'll always be talk of Trollocs attacking a farm or the like. This winter past, though, there'll be farms burning every night. Aye, and whole villages, too, betimes. They even came right up to the city walls. And if that be no bad enough, the people be all saying it meant the Dark One be stirring, that the last days be come.
He gave a shiver and scratched at his head, as if the thought made his scalp itch.
I can no wait to get back where people think Trollocs be just tales. The stories I tell be travelers' lies.
Rand stopped listening. He stared at the opposite wall and thought about Egwene and the others. It hardly seemed right for him to be safe on the spray, while they were still back there in the night somewhere. The captain's cabin did not seem so comfortable as before. He was surprised when Tom pulled him to his feet. The gleeman pushed Matt and him toward the ladder, with apologies over his shoulder to Captain Doman for the country louts. Rand climbed up without a word. Once they were on deck, Tom looked around quickly to make sure he would not be overheard, then growled, "'I could have gotten us passage for a few songs and stories if you two hadn't been so quick to show silver.'
"'I'm not so sure,' Matt said. "'He sounded serious about throwing us in the river to me.'
Rand walked slowly to the rail and leaned against it, staring back up the night-shrouded river. He could not see anything but black, not even the river bank. After a minute, Tom put a hand on his shoulder, but he did not move.
"'There isn't anything you can do, lad. Besides, they're likely safe with Moraine and Lan by this time. Can you think of any better than those two for getting the lot of them clear?'
"'I tried to talk her out of coming,' Rand said.
"'You did what you could, lad. No one could ask more.
"'I told her I'd take care of her. I should have tried harder.'
"'The creak of the sweeps and the hum of the rigging in the wind made a mournful tune.
"'I should have tried harder,'
he whispered.
Chapter 21 Listen to the Wind Sunrise creeping across the River Arunel found its way into the hollow not far from the riverbank where Nynaeve sat with her back against the trunk of a young oak, breathing the deep breath of sleep. Her horse slept, too, head down and legs spraddled in the manner of horses. The reins were wrapped around her wrist. As sunlight fell on the horse's eyelids, the animal opened its eyes and raised its head, jerking the reins. Nynaeve came awake with a start. For a moment she stared, wondering where she was, then stared around even more wildly when she remembered. But there were only the trees, and her horse, and a carpet of old dry leaves across the bottom of the hollow. In the deepest dimness some of last year's Shadow's Hand mushrooms made rings on a fallen log. "'The light preserve you, woman,' she murmured, sagging back. "'If you can't stay awake one night—' She untied the reins and massaged her wrist as she stood. You could have awakened in a Trolloc cook-pot. The dead leaves rustled as she climbed to the lip of the hollow and peeped over. No more than a handful of ash trees stood between her and the river. Their fissured bark and bare branches made them seem dead. Beyond, the wide blue-green water flowed by, empty. Empty of anything. Scattered clumps of evergreens, willows, and firs dotted the far bank, and there seemed to be fewer trees altogether than on her side. If Moiraine or any of the younglings were over there, they were well hidden. Of course, there was no reason they had to have crossed, or tried to cross, in sight of where she was. They could be anywhere, 10 miles upriver or down. If they're alive at all, after last night. Angry with herself for thinking of the possibility, she slid back down into the hollow. Not even Winter Night, or the battle before Shadar Logoth, had prepared her for last night, for that thing, Mashadar. All that frantic galloping, wondering if anyone else was still alive, wondering when she was going to come face to face with a Fade or Trollocs. She had heard Trollocs growling and shouting in the distance, and the quivering shrieks of Trolloc horns had chilled her deeper than the wind ever could, but aside from that first encounter in the ruins, she saw Trollocs only once, and that once she was outside. 10 or so of them seemed to spring out of the ground not 30 spans in front of her, bounding toward her on the instant, howling and shouting, brandishing hooked catch-poles. Yet as she pulled her horse around, they fell silent, lifting muzzles to sniff at the air. She watched, too astonished to run, as they turned their backs and vanished into the night. And that had been the most frightening of all. "They know the smell of who they want," she told her horse, standing in the hollow. "And it is not me. The Aes Sedai is right, it seems. The shepherd of the night swallow her up." Reaching a decision, she set out downriver, leading her horse. She moved slowly, keeping a wary watch on the forest around her. Just because the Trollocs had not wanted her last night did not mean they would let her go if she stumbled on them again. As much attention as she gave the woods, she gave even more to the ground in front of her. If the others had crossed below her during the night, she should see some signs of them, signs she might miss from horseback. She might even come on them all still on this side. If she found neither, the river would take her to Whitebridge eventually, and there was a road from Whitebridge to Camelin, and all the way to Tar Valon if need be. The prospect was almost enough to daunt her. Before this, she had been no further from Emmons Field than had the boys. Taran Ferry had seemed strange to her. Bearlon would have had her staring in wonder if she had not been so set on finding Egwene and the others. But she allowed none of that to weaken her resolve. Sooner or later she would find Egwene and the boys, or find a way to make the Aes Sedai answer for whatever had happened to them. One or the other, she vowed. At intervals she found tracks, plenty of them, but usually her best efforts could not say whether those who made them had been searching or chasing or pursued. Some had been made by boots that could have belonged to humans or Trollocs, either one. Others were hoofprints like goats or oxen. Those were Trollocs for sure. But never a clear sign that she could definitely say came from any of those she sought. She'd covered perhaps 4 miles when the wind brought her a whiff of wood smoke. It came from further downriver, and not too far, she thought. She hesitated only a moment before tying her horse to a fir tree, well back from the river in a small, thick stand of evergreens that should keep the animal hidden. The smoke could mean Trollocs, but the only way to find out was to look. She tried not to think about the use Trollocs might be making of a fire. Crouching, she slipped from tree to tree, mentally cursing the skirts she had to hold up out of the way. Dresses were not made for stalking. The sound of a horse slowed her, and when she finally peered cautiously around the trunk of an ash, the warder was dismounting from his black warhorse in a small clearing on the bank. The Aes Sedai sat on a log beside a small fire, where a kettle of water was just coming to a boil. Her white mare browsed behind her among sparse weeds. Nynaeve remained where she was. "They are all gone," Lan announced grimly. 4 halfmen started south about 2 hours before dawn, as near as I can tell. They don't leave much trace behind. But the Trollocs have vanished, even the corpses, and Trollocs are not known for carrying off their dead, unless they're hungry. Moiraine tossed a handful of something into the boiling water and moved the kettle from the fire. "One could always hope they had gone back into Shadar Logoth and been consumed by it, but that would be too much to wish for. The delicious odor of tea drifted to Nynaeve. Light, don't let my stomach grumble. There was no clear sign of the boys or any of the others. The tracks are too muddled to tell anything. In her concealment, Nynaeve smiled. The warder's failure was a slight vindication of her own. But this other is important, Moiraine, Lan went on, frowning. He waved away the Aes Sedai's offer of tea and began marching up and down in front of the fire, one hand on his sword hilt and his cloak changing colors as he turned. I could accept Trollocs in 2 rivers, even 100 Trollocs, but this? There must have been almost 1,000 in the hunt for us yesterday. We were very lucky that not all stayed to search Shadar Logoth. The Merdral must have doubted we would hide there, but they also feared to return to Sheol Ghul, leaving even the slightest chance uncovered. The Dark One was never a lenient master. Don't try to evade it. You know what I'm saying. If those 1,000 were here to be sent into the 2 rivers, why were they not? There is only one answer. They were sent only after we crossed the Tauran, when it was known that 1 Merdral and 100 Trollocs were no longer enough. How? How were they sent? If 1,000 Trollocs can be brought so far south from the Blight, so quickly, unseen, not to mention being taken off the same way, can 10,000 be sent into the heart of Saldaea, or Arafel, or Shinar? The borderlands could be overrun in a year. The whole world will be overrun in 5 if we do not find those boys, Moiraine said simply. The question worries me also, but I have no answers. The ways are closed, and there has not been an Aes Sedai powerful enough to travel since the time of madness. Unless one of the Forsaken is loose, the light send it is not so, yet or ever. There is still no one who can. In any case, I do not think all the Forsaken together could move 1,000 Trollocs. Let us deal with the problems that face us here and now. Everything else must wait. The boys. It was not a question. I have not been idle while you were away. One is across the river and alive. As for the others, there was a faint trace downriver, but it faded away as I found it. The bond had been broken for hours before I began my search. Crouched behind her tree, Nynaeve frowned in puzzlement. Lan stopped his pacing. You think the half-men heading south have them? Perhaps. Moiraine poured herself a cup of tea before going on. But I will not admit the possibility of them being dead. I cannot. I dare not. You know how much is at stake. I must have those young men. That Sheol Ghul will hunt them, I expect. Opposition from within the White Tower, even from the Amarlin seat, I accept. There are always Aes Sedai who will accept only one solution. But suddenly she put her cup down and sat up straight, grimacing. If you watch the wolf too hard, she muttered, a mouse will bite you on the ankle. And she looked right at the tree behind which Nynaeve was hiding. Mistress Almira, you may come out now if you wish. Nynaeve scrambled to her feet, hastily dusting dead leaves from her dress. Lan had spun to face the tree as soon as Moiraine's eyes moved. His sword was in his hand before she finished speaking Nynaeve's name. Now he sheathed it again with more force than was strictly necessary. His face was almost as expressionless as ever, but Nynaeve thought there was a touch of chagrin about the set of his mouth. She felt a stab of satisfaction. The warder had not known she was there, at least. Satisfaction lasted only a moment, though. She fastened her eyes on Moiraine and walked toward her purposefully. She wanted to remain cold and calm, but her voice quivered with anger. What have you meshed Egwene and the boys in? What filthy Aes Sedai plots are you planning to use them in? The Aes Sedai picked up her cup and calmly sipped her tea. When Nynaeve was close, though, Lan put out an arm to bar her way. She tried to brush the obstruction aside and was surprised when the warder's arm moved no more than an oak branch would have. She was not frail, but his muscles were like iron. Tea? Moiraine offered. No, I don't want any tea. I would not drink your tea if I was dying of thirst. You won't use any Emmons Field folk in your dirty Aes Sedai schemes. You have very little room to talk, wisdom. Moiraine showed more interest in her hot tea than in anything she was saying. You can wield the One Power yourself, after a fashion. Nynaeve pushed at Lan's arm again. It still did not move, and she decided to ignore it. Why don't you try claiming I am a Trolloc? Moiraine's smile was so knowing that Nynaeve wanted to hit her. Do you think I can stand face to face with a woman who can touch the true source and channel the One Power, even if only now and then, without knowing what she is? Just as you sense the potential in Egwene. How do you think I knew you were behind that tree? If I had not been distracted, I would have known the moment you came close. You certainly are not a Trolloc for me to feel the evil of the Dark One. So what did I sense, Nynaeve Almira, wisdom of Emmons Field and unknowing wielder of the One Power? Lan was looking down at Nynaeve in a way she did not like. Surprised and speculative, it seemed to her, though nothing had changed about his face but his eyes. Egwene was special. She'd always known that. Egwene would make a fine wisdom. They're working together, she thought, trying to put me off balance. I won't listen to any more of this. You must listen, Moiraine said firmly. I had my suspicions in Emmons Field even before I met you. People told me how upset the wisdom was that she had not predicted the hard winter and the lateness of spring. They told me how good she was at foretelling weather, at telling the crops. They told me how wonderful her cures were, how she sometimes healed injuries that should have been crippling so well there was barely a scar and not a limp or a twinge. The only ill word I heard about you was from a few who thought you too young for the responsibility, and that only strengthened my suspicions. So much skill, so young. Mistress Baron taught me well. She tried looking at Lan, but his eyes still made her uncomfortable, so she settled for staring over the Aes Sedai's head at the river. How dare the village gossip in front of an outlander? Who said I was too young? She demanded. Moiraine smiled, refusing to be diverted. Unlike most women who claim to listen to the wind, you actually can, sometimes. Oh, it has nothing to do with the wind, of course. It is of air and water. It is not something you need to be taught. It was born into you, just as it was born into Egwene. But you have learned to handle it, which she still has to learn. 2 minutes after I came face to face with you, I knew. Do you remember how I suddenly asked you if you were the wisdom? Why, do you think? There was nothing to distinguish you from any other pretty young woman getting ready for festival. Even looking for a young wisdom, I expected someone half again your age. Nynaeve remembered that meeting all too well. This woman, more self-possessed than anyone in the women's circle, in a dress more beautiful than any she had ever seen, addressing her as a child. Then Moiraine had suddenly blinked, as if surprised, and out of a clear sky asked... She licked lips, gone abruptly dry. They were both looking at her, the warder's face as unreadable as a stone, the Aes Sedai's, sympathetic yet intent. Nynaeve shook her head. No! No, it's impossible. I would know. You are just trying to trick me, and it will not work. Of course you do not know, Moiraine said soothingly. Why should you even suspect? All of your life you have heard about listening to the wind. In any case, you would as soon announce to all of Emmons Field that you were a dark friend as admit to yourself, even in the deepest recesses of your mind, that you have anything to do with the One Power or the dreaded Aes Sedai. Amusement flitted across Moiraine's face. But I can tell you how it began. I don't want to hear any more of your lies, she said, but the Aes Sedai went right on. Perhaps as much as 8 or 10 years ago, the age varies but always comes young, there was something you wanted more than anything else in the world, something you needed, and you got it. A branch suddenly falling where you could pull yourself out of a pond instead of drowning, a friend or a pet getting well when everyone thought they would die. You felt nothing special at the time, but a week or 10 days later you had your first reaction to touching the true source. Perhaps fevers and chills that came on suddenly and put you to bed, then disappeared after only a few hours. None of the reactions, and they vary, lasts more than a few hours. Headaches and numbness and exhilaration all mixed together, and you taking foolish chances or acting giddy. A spell of dizziness when you tripped and stumbled whenever you tried to move, when you could not say a sentence without your tongue mangling half the words. There are others. Do you remember? Nynaeve sat down hard on the ground. Her legs would not hold her up. She remembered, but she shook her head anyway. It had to be coincidence. Or else Moiraine had asked more questions in Emmon's field than she had thought. The Aes Sedai had asked a great many questions. It had to be that. Lan offered a hand, but she did not even see it. I will go further, Moiraine said when Nynaeve kept silent. You used the power to heal either Perrin or Egwene at some time. An affinity develops. You can sense the presence of someone you have healed. In Bearlon, you came straight to the Stag and Lion, though it was not the nearest inn to any gate by which you could have entered. Of the people from Emmon's field, only Perrin and Egwene were at the inn when you arrived. Was it Perrin or Egwene, or both? Egwene, Nynaeve mumbled. She'd always taken it for granted that she could sometimes tell who was approaching her, even when she could not see them. Not until now had she realized that it was always someone on whom her cures had worked almost miraculously well. And she had always known when the medicine would work beyond expectations, always felt the certainty when she said the crops would be especially good, or that the rains would come early or late. That was the way she thought it was supposed to be. Not all wisdoms could listen to the wind, but the best could. That was what Mistress Baron always said, just as she said Nynaeve would be one of the best. She had breakbone fever. She kept her head down and spoke to the ground. I was still apprentice to Mistress Baron, and she set me to watch Egwene. I was young, and I didn't know the wisdom had everything well in hand. It's terrible to watch, breakbone fever. The child was soaked with sweat, groaning and twisting until I could not understand why I didn't hear her bones snapping. Mistress Baron had told me the fever would break in another day, two at the most, but I thought she was doing me a kindness. I thought Egwene was dying. I used to look after her sometimes when she was a toddler, when her mother was busy, and I started crying because I was going to have to watch her die. When Mistress Baron came back an hour later, the fever had broken. She was surprised, but she made over me more than Egwene. I always thought she believed I had given the child something and was too frightened to admit it. I always thought she was trying to comfort me, to make sure I knew I hadn't hurt Egwene. A week later I fell on the floor in her sitting room, shaking and burning up by turns. She bundled me into bed, but by supper time it was gone. She dropped her head in her hands as she finished speaking. The Aes Sedai chose a good example, she thought. Light burn her. Using the power like an Aes Sedai. A filthy, dark friend Aes Sedai. You were very lucky, Moiraine said, and Nynaeve sat erect. Lan stepped back as if what they talked about was none of his business, and busied himself with Mandarb's saddle, not even glancing at them. Lucky! You have managed a crude control over the power, even if touching the true source still comes at random. If you had not, it would have killed you eventually. As it will, in all probability, kill Egwene, if you manage to stop her from going to Tar Valon. If I learned to control it... Nynaeve swallowed hard. It was like admitting all over again that she could do what the Aes Sedai said. If I learned to control it, so can she. There is no need for her to go to Tar Valon and get mixed up in your intrigues. Moiraine shook her head slowly. Aes Sedai search for girls who can touch the true source unguided just as assiduously as we search for men who can do so. It is not a desire to increase our numbers, or at least not only that. Nor is it a fear that those women will misuse the power. The rough control of the power they may gain if the light shines on them is rarely enough to do any great damage, especially since the actual touching of the source is beyond their control without a teacher, and comes only randomly. And, of course, they do not suffer the madness that drives men to evil or twisted things. We want to save their lives, the lives of those who never do manage any control at all. The fever and chills I had couldn't kill anyone, Nynaeve insisted. Not in 3 or 4 hours. I had the other things, too, and they couldn't kill anybody either. And they stopped after a few months. What about that? Those were only reactions, Moiraine said patiently. Each time the reaction comes closer to the actual touching of the source, until the two happen almost together. After that, there are no more reactions that can be seen, but it is as if a clock has begun ticking. 1 year? 2 years? I know one woman who lasted 5 years. Of 4 who have the inborn ability that you and Egwene have, 3 die if we do not find them and train them. It is not as horrible a death as the men die, but neither is it pretty, if any death can be called so. Convulsions? Screaming? It takes days, and once it begins, there is nothing that can be done to stop it, not by all the Aes Sedai and Tar Valon together. You're lying! All those questions you asked in Emmons Field. You found out about Egwene's fever breaking, about my fever and chills, all of it. You made all of this up. You know I did not, Moiraine said gently. Reluctantly, more reluctantly than she had ever done anything in her life, Nynaeve nodded. It had been a last stubborn effort to deny what was plain, and there was never any good in that, however unpleasant it might be. Mistress Baron's first apprentice had died the way the Aes Sedai said when Nynaeve was still playing with dolls, and there had been a young woman in Devon Ride only a few years ago. She had been a wisdom's apprentice, too, one who could listen to the wind. You have great potential, I think, Moiraine continued. With training, you might become even more powerful than Egwene, and I believe she can become one of the most powerful Aes Sedai we have seen in centuries. Nynaeve pushed herself back from the Aes Sedai as she would have from a viper. No! I'll have nothing to do with... With what? Myself? She slumped, and her voice became hesitant. I would ask you not to tell anyone about this. Please? The word nearly stuck in her throat. She would rather Trollocs had appeared than she had been forced to say please to this woman. But Moiraine only nodded assent, and some of her spirit returned. None of this explains what you want with Rand and Matt and Perrin. The Dark One wants them, Moiraine replied. If the Dark One wants a thing, I oppose it. Can there be a simpler reason or a better? She finished her tea, watching Nynaeve over the rim of her cup. Lan, we must be going. South, I think. I fear the wisdom will not be accompanying us. Nynaeve's mouth tightened at the way the Aes Sedai said, wisdom. It seemed to suggest she was turning her back on great things in favor of something petty. She doesn't want me along. She's trying to put my back up, so I'll go back home and leave them alone with her. Oh, yes, I will be going with you. You cannot keep me from it. No one will try to keep you from it, Lan said as he rejoined them. He emptied the tea kettle over the fire and stirred the ashes with a stick. A part of the pattern, he said to Moiraine. Perhaps so, she replied thoughtfully. I should have spoken to Min again. You see, Nynaeve, you are welcome to come. There was a hesitation in the way Lan said her name, a hint of an unspoken Sedai after it. Nynaeve bristled, taking it for mockery, and bristled too at the way they spoke of things in front of her, things she knew nothing about, without the courtesy of an explanation, but she would not give them the satisfaction of asking. The warder went on preparing for departure, his economical motions so sure and swift that he was quickly done, saddlebags, blankets, and all fastened behind the saddles of Mandarb and Aldib. I will fetch your horse, he told Nynaeve, as he finished with the last saddle tie. He started up the riverbank, and she allowed herself a small smile. After the way she had watched him undiscovered, he was going to try to find her horse unaided. He would learn that she left little in the way of tracks when she was stalking. It would be a pleasure when he came back empty-handed. Why south? She asked Moiraine. I heard you say one of the boys is across the river. And how do you know? I gave each of the boys a token. It created a bond of sorts between them and me. So long as they are alive and have those coins in their possession, I will be able to find them. Nynaeve's eyes turned in the direction the warder had gone, and Moiraine shook her head. Not like that. It only allows me to discover if they still live, and find them should we become separated. Prudent, do you not think, under the circumstances? I don't like anything that connects you with anyone from Emmons Field, Nynaeve said stubbornly. But if it will help us find them, it will. I would gather the young man across the river first if I could. For a moment, frustration tinged the Aes Sedai's voice. He is only a few miles from us, but I cannot afford to take the time. He should make his way down to Whitebridge safely now that the Trollocs have gone. The two who went downriver may need me more. They have lost their coins, and Myrdral are either pursuing them or else trying to intercept us all at Whitebridge. She sighed. I must take care of the greatest need first. The Myrdral could have killed them, Nynaeve said. Moiraine shook her head slightly, denying the suggestion as if it were too trivial to be considered. Nynaeve's mouth tightened. Where is Egwene, then? You haven't even mentioned her. I do not know, Moiraine admitted, but I hope that she is safe. You don't know? You hope? All that talk about saving her life by taking her to Tar Valon, and she could be dead for all you know. I could look for her and allow the Myrdral more time before I arrive to help the two young men who went south. It is them the Dark One wants, not her. They would not bother with Egwene, so long as their true quarry remains uncaught. Nynaeve remembered her own encounter, but she refused to admit the sense of what Moiraine said. So the best you have to offer is that she may be alive, if she was lucky. Alive, maybe alone, frightened, even hurt, days from the nearest village or help except for us, and you intend to leave her. She may just as easily be safe with the boy across the river, or on her way to Whitebridge with the other two. In any case, there are no longer Trollocs here to threaten her, and she is strong, intelligent, and quite capable of finding her way to Whitebridge alone if need be. Would you rather stay on the chance that she may need help, or do you want to try to help those we know are in need? Would you have me search for her and let the boys and the Myrdral who are surely pursuing them go? As much as I hope for Egwene's safety, Nynaeve, I fight against the Dark One, and for now that sets my path. Moiraine's calm never slipped while she laid out the horrible alternatives. Nynaeve wanted to scream at her. Blinking back tears, she turned her face so the Aes Sedai could not see. Light. A wisdom is supposed to look after all of her people. Why do I have to choose like this? Here is Lan, Moiraine said, rising and settling her cloak about her shoulders. To Nynaeve it was only a tiny blow as the warder led her horse out of the trees. Still, her lips thinned when he handed her the reins. It would have been a small boost to her spirits if there had been even a trace of gloating on his face instead of that insufferable stony calm. His eyes widened when he saw her face, and she turned her back on him to wipe tears from her cheeks. How dare he mock my crying! Are you coming, Wisdom? Moiraine asked coolly. She took one last slow look at the forest, wondering if Egwene was out there before sadly mounting her horse. Lan and Moiraine were already in their saddles, turning their horses south. She followed, stiff-backed, refusing to let herself look back. Instead, she kept her eyes on Moiraine. The Aes Sedai was so confident in her power and her plans, she thought, but if they did not find Egwene and the boys, all of them, alive and unharmed, not all of her power would protect her. Not all her power. I can use it, woman. You told me so yourself. I can use it against you.
Chapter 22. A Path Chosen. In a small copse of trees, beneath a pile of cedar branches, roughly cut in the dark, Perrin slept long after sunrise. It was the cedar needles, pricking him through his still damp clothes, that finally pricked through his exhaustion as well. Deep in a dream of Emmonsfield, of working at Master Luhan's forge, He opened his eyes and stared, uncomprehendingly, at the sweet-smelling branches interwoven over his face, sunlight trickling through. Most of the branches fell away as he sat up in surprise, but some hung haphazardly from his shoulders and even his head, making him appear something like a tree himself. Emmonsfield faded as memory rushed back, so vivid that for a moment the night before seemed more real than anything around him now. Panting, frantic, he scrabbled his axe out of the pile. He clutched it in both hands and peered around cautiously, holding his breath. Nothing moved. The morning was cold and still. If there were Trollocs on the east bank of the Arunel, they were not moving, or at least not close to him. Taking a deep, calming breath, he lowered the axe to his knees and waited a moment for his heart to stop pounding. The small stand of evergreens surrounding him was the first shelter he had found last night. It was sparse enough to give little protection against watching eyes if he stood up. Plucking branches from his head and shoulders, he pushed aside the rest of his prickly blanket, then crawled on hands and knees to the edge of the copse. There he lay, studying the riverbank and scratching where the needles had stabbed him. The cutting wind of the night before had faded to a silent breeze that barely rippled the surface of the water. The river ran by, calm and empty, and wide. Surely too wide and too deep for fades to cross. The far bank appeared a solid mass of trees as far as he could see upriver and down. Certainly nothing moved in his view over there. He was not sure how he felt about that. Fades and Trollocs he could do without quite easily, even on the other side of the river. But a whole list of worries would have vanished with the appearance of the Aes Sedai, or the warder, or even better, any of his friends. If wishes were wings, sheep would fly. That was what Mistress Luhan always said. He had not seen a sign of his horse since riding over the bluff. He hoped it had swum out of the river safely, but he was more used to walking than riding anyway, and his boots were stout and well-soled. He had nothing to eat, but his sling was still wrapped around his waist, and that, or the snare lines in his pocket, ought to yield a rabbit in a little time. Everything for making a fire was gone with his saddlebags, but the cedar trees would yield tinder and a fire bow with a bit of work. He shivered as the breeze gusted into his hiding place. His cloak was somewhere in the river, and his coat and everything else he wore were still clammy cold from the soaking in the river. He had been too tired for the cold and damp to bother him last night, but now he was wide awake to every chill. Just the same, he decided against hanging his clothes in the branches to dry. If the day was not precisely cold, it was not even close to warm. Time was the problem, he thought with a sigh. Dry clothes with a little time, a rabbit to roast and the fire to roast it over with a little time. His stomach rumbled, and he tried to forget about eating altogether. There were more important uses for that time. One thing at a time, and the most important first. That was his way. His eyes followed the strong flow of the Arunel downriver. He was a stronger swimmer than Egwene. If she had made it across... No, not if. The place where she had made it across would be downriver. He drummed on the ground with his fingers, weighing, considering. His decision made, he wasted no time in picking up his axe and setting off downriver. This side of the Arunel lacked the thick forest of the west bank. Clumps of trees spotted across what would be grassland if spring ever came. Some were big enough to be called thickets, with swathes of evergreens among the barren ash and alder and hardgum. Down by the river, the stands were smaller and not so tight. They gave poor cover, but they were all the cover there was. He dashed from growth to growth in a crouch, throwing himself down when he was among the trees to study the river banks, the far side as well as his. The warder said the river would be a barrier to fades and Trollocs, but would it? Seeing him might be enough to overcome their reluctance to cross deep water. So he watched carefully from behind the trees and ran from one hiding place to the next, fast and low. He covered several miles that way, in spurts, until suddenly, halfway to the beckoning shelter of a growth of willows, he grunted and stopped dead, staring at the ground. Patches of bare earth spotted the matted brown of last year's grass, and in the middle of one of those patches, right under his nose was a clear hoof print. A slow smile spread across his face. Some Trollocs had hooves, but he doubted if any wore horseshoes, especially horseshoes with the double crossbar Master Luhan added for strength. Forgetting possible eyes on the other side of the river, he cast about for more tracks. The plaited carpet of dead grass did not take impressions well, but his sharp eyes found them anyway. The scanty trail led him straight away from the river to a dense stand of trees, thick with leather leaf and cedar, that made a wall against wind or prying eyes. The spreading branches of a lone hemlock towered in the middle of it all. Still grinning, he pushed his way through the interwoven branches, not caring how much noise he made. Abruptly, he stepped into a little clearing under the hemlock and stopped. Behind a small fire, Egwene crouched, her face grim, with a thick branch held like a club and her back against Bella's flank. "I guess I should have called out," he said with an abashed shrug. Tossing her club down, she ran to throw her arms around him.
"I thought you had drowned. You're still wet. Here, sit by the fire and warm yourself. You lost your horse, didn't you?"
He let her push him to a place by the fire and rubbed his hands over the flames, grateful for the warmth. She produced an oiled paper packet from her saddlebags and gave him some bread and cheese. The package had been so tightly wrapped that even after its dunking, the food was dry. "Here you were worrying about her, and she's done better than you did."
"Bella got me across," Egwene said, patting the shaggy mare. "She headed away from the Trollocs and just towed me along."
She paused.
"I haven't seen anybody else, Perrin."
He heard the unspoken question. Regretfully eyeing the packet that she was rewrapping, he licked the last crumbs from his fingers before speaking.
"I've seen no one but you since last night. No Fades or Trollocs either. There's that."
"Rand has to be all right," Egwene said, quickly adding, "They all do. They have to. They're probably looking for us right now. They might find us any time now. Moraine is an Aes Sedai, after all."
"I keep being reminded of that," he said. "Burn me, I wish I could forget."
"I did not hear you complaining when she stopped the Trollocs from catching us," Egwene said tartly.
"I just wish we could do without her."
He shrugged uncomfortably under her steady gaze.
"I suppose we can't, though. I've been thinking."
Her eyebrows rose, but he was used to surprise whenever he claimed an idea. Even when his ideas were as good as theirs, they always remembered how deliberate he was in thinking of them.
"We can wait for Lan and Moraine to find us."
"Of course," she cut in. "Moraine Sedai said she would find us if we were separated."
He let her finish, then went on.
"Or the Trollocs could find us first. Moraine could be dead, too. All of them could be." "No, Egwene. I'm sorry, but they could be. I hope they are all safe. I hope they'll walk up to this fire any minute. But hope is like a piece of string when you're drowning. It just isn't enough to get you out by itself."
Egwene closed her mouth and stared at him with her jaw set. Finally, she said,
"You want to go downriver to Whitebridge? If Moraine Sedai doesn't find us here, that's where she will look next."
"I suppose," he said slowly, "that Whitebridge is where we should go. But the Fades probably know that, too. That's where they'll be looking. And this time we don't have an Aes Sedai or a warder to protect us."
"I suppose you're going to suggest running off somewhere, the way Matt wanted to? Hiding somewhere the Fades and Trollocs won't find us? Or Moraine Sedai, either?"
"Don't think I haven't considered it," he said quietly. "But every time we think we are free, Fades and Trollocs find us again. I don't know if there is any place we could hide from them. I don't like it much, but we need Moraine."
"I don't understand then, Perrin. Where do we go?"
He blinked in surprise. She was waiting for his answer, waiting for him to tell her what to do. It had never occurred to him that she would look to him to take the lead. Egwene never liked doing what someone else had planned out, and she never let anybody tell her what to do, except maybe the wisdom, and he thought sometimes she balked at that. He smoothed the dirt in front of him with his hand and cleared his throat roughly.
"If this is where we are now, and that is Whitebridge,"
He stabbed the ground twice with his finger. Then Camelin should be somewhere around here. He made a third mark, off to the side. He paused, looking at the three dots in the dirt. His entire plan was based on what he remembered of her father's old map. Master Alvear said it was not too accurate, and anyway, he had never mooned over it as much as Rand and Matt. But Egwene said nothing. When he looked up, she was still watching him with her hands in her lap.
Camelin?
She sounded stunned. Camelin. He drew a line in the dirt between two of the dots. Away from the river and straight across. Nobody would expect that. We'll wait for them in Camelin. He dusted his hands and waited. He thought it was a good plan, but surely she would have objections now. He expected she would take charge. She was always bullying him into something, and that was all right with him. To his surprise, she nodded.
There must be villages. We can ask directions.
What worries me, Perrin said, is what we do if the Aes Sedai doesn't find us there.
Light.
Who'd ever have thought I'd worry about something like that? What if she doesn't come to Camelin? Maybe she thinks we're dead. Maybe she'll take Rand and Matt straight to Tar Valon.
Moraine Sedai said she could find us, Egwene said firmly. If she can find us here, she can find us in Camelin. And she will.
Perrin nodded slowly. If you say so. But if she doesn't appear in Camelin in a few days, we go on to Tar Valon and put our case before the Amarlan seat. He took a deep breath. 2 weeks ago you'd never even seen an Aes Sedai, and now you're talking about the Amarlan seat.
Light!
According to Lan, there's a good road from Camelin. He looked at the oiled paper packet beside Egwene and cleared his throat. What chance of a little more bread and cheese?
This might have to last a long time, she said, unless you have better luck with snares than I did last night. At least the fire was easy.
She laughed softly as if she had made a joke, tucking the packet back into her saddlebags. Apparently there were limits to how much leadership she was willing to accept. His stomach rumbled. In that case, he said, standing, we might as well start now.
But you're still wet, she protested.
I'll walk myself dry, he said firmly, and began kicking dirt over the fire. If he was the leader, it was time to start leading. The wind from the river was picking up. Chapter 23 Wolf Brother. From the start, Perrin knew the journey to Camelin was going to be far from comfortable, beginning with Egwene's insistence that they take turns riding Bella. They did not know how far it was, she said, but it was too far for her to be the only one who rode. Her jaw firmed, and her eyes stared at him unblinking.
I'm too big to ride Bella, he said. I'm used to walking, and I'd rather.
And I'm not used to walking? Egwene said sharply.
That isn't what I...
I'm the only one who's supposed to get saddle sore, is that it? And when you walk till your feet are ready to fall off, you'll expect me to look after you.
Let it be, he breathed when she looked like going on. Anyway, you'll take the first turn. Her face turned even more stubborn, but he refused to let her get a word in edgewise. If you won't get in the saddle by yourself, I'll put you there. She gave him a startled look, and a small smile curved her lips.
In that case...
She sounded as if she were about to laugh, but she climbed up. He grumbled to himself as he turned away from the river. Leaders in stories never had to put up with this sort of thing. Egwene did insist on him taking his turns, and whenever he tried to avoid it, she bullied him into the saddle. Blacksmithing did not lend itself to a slender build, and Bella was not very large as horses went. Every time he put his foot in the stirrup, the shaggy mare looked at him with what he was sure was reproach. Small things, perhaps, but they irritated. Soon he flinched whenever Egwene announced,
It's your turn, Perrin.
In stories, leaders seldom flinched, and they were never bullied. But, he reflected, they never had to deal with Egwene, either. There were only short rations of bread and cheese to begin with,
and what there was gave out by the end of the first day. Perrin set snares along likely rabbit runs. They looked old, but it was worth a chance. While Egwene began laying a fire. When he was done, he decided to try his hand with his sling before the light failed altogether. They had not seen a sign of anything at all alive, but, to his surprise, he jumped a scrawny rabbit almost at once. He was so surprised when it burst from under a bush right beneath his feet that it almost got away. But he fetched it at 40 paces, just as it was darting around a tree. When he came back to the camp with the rabbit, Egwene had broken limbs all laid for the fire, but she was kneeling beside the pile with her eyes closed. "What are you doing? You can't wish a fire." Egwene gave a jump at his first words and twisted around to stare at him with a hand to her throat.
You startled me."
"I was lucky," he said, holding up the rabbit. "Get your flint and steel. We eat well tonight, at least."
"I don't have a flint," she said slowly. "It was in my pocket, and I lost it in the river."
"Then how?"
"It was so easy back there on the riverbank, Perrin. Just the way Moraine said I showed me. I just reached out and..."
She gestured as if grasping for something, then let her hand fall with a sigh.
"I can't find it now."
Perrin licked his lips uneasily.
The power?
She nodded, and he stared at her.
"Are you crazy? I mean, the one power? You can't just play around with something like that." "It was so easy, Perrin. I can do it. I can channel the power."
He took a deep breath. "I'll make a fire, Boa Gwaine.
Promise you won't try this thing again." "I will not."
Her jaw firmed in a way that made him sigh.
"Would you give up that axe of yours, Perrin Ebarra? Would you walk around with one hand tied behind your back? I won't do it."
"I'll make the fire, Bo," he said wearily. "At least don't try it again tonight. Please?" She acquiesced grudgingly, and even after the rabbit was roasting on a spit over the flames, he had the feeling she felt she could have done it better. She would not give up trying either. Every night, though the best she ever did was a trickle of smoke that vanished almost immediately. Her eyes dared him to say a word, and he wisely kept his mouth shut. After that one hot meal, they subsisted on coarse, wild tubers and a few young shoots. With still no sign of spring, none of it was plentiful, and none of it was tasty either. Neither complained, but not a meal passed without one or the other sighing regretfully, and they both knew it was for the tang of a bit of cheese, or even the smell of bread. A find of mushrooms, queen's crowns, the best, one afternoon in a shady part of the forest was enough to seem a great treat. They gobbled them down, laughing and telling stories from back in Emmons Field.
Stories that began, "Do you remember when?"
But the mushrooms did not last long, and neither did the laughter. There was little mirth in hunger. Whichever was walking carried a sling, ready to let fly at the sight of a rabbit or squirrel, but the only time either hurled a stone was in frustration. The snares they set so carefully each evening yielded nothing at dawn, and they did not dare stay a day in one place to leave the snares out. Neither of them knew how far it was to Camelin, and neither would feel safe until they got there, if then. Perrin began to wonder if his stomach could shrink enough to make a hole all the way through his middle. They made good time, as he saw it, but as they got farther and farther from the RNL without seeing a village or even a farmhouse where they could ask directions, his doubts about his own plan grew. Egwene continued to appear outwardly as confident as when they set out, but he was sure that sooner or later she would say it would have been better to risk the Trollocs than to wander around lost for the rest of their lives. She never did, but he kept expecting it. 2 days from the river, the land changed to thickly forested hills, as gripped by the tail end of winter as everywhere else, and a day after that the hills flattened out again, the dense forest broken by glades, often a mile or more across. Snow still lay in hidden hollows, and the air was brisk of a morning, and the wind cold always.
Nowhere did they see a road, or a plowed field, or chimney smoke in the distance, or any other sign of human habitation. At least, none where men still dwelt. Once the remains of tall stone ramparts encircled a hilltop. Parts of roofless stone houses stood inside the fallen circle. The forest had long swallowed it. Trees grew right through everything, and spider webs of old creeper enveloped the big stone blocks. Another time they came on a stone tower, broken-topped and brown with old moss, leaning on the huge oak whose thick roots were slowly toppling it. But they found no place where men had breathed in living remembrance. Memories of Shadar-Logoth kept them away from the ruins and hurried their footsteps until they were once more deep in places that seemed never to have known a human footstep. Dreams plagued Perrin's sleep, fearful dreams. Baal-Zamun was in them, chasing him through mazes, hunting him, but Perrin never met him face to face, so far as he remembered. And their journey had been enough to bring a few bad dreams. Egwene complained of nightmares about Shadar-Logoth, especially the two nights after they found the ruined fort and the abandoned tower. Perrin kept his own counsel, even when he woke sweating and shaking in the dark. She was looking to him to lead them safely to Camelin, not share worries about which they could do nothing. He was walking at Bella's head, wondering if they would find anything to eat this evening, when he first caught the smell. The mare flared her nostrils and swung her head in the next moment. He seized her bridle before she could wick her.
"That's smoke," Egwene said excitedly.
She leaned forward in the saddle, drew a deep breath.
"A cook fire! Somebody is roasting dinner. Rabbit."
"Maybe," Perrin said cautiously, and her eager smile faded. He exchanged his sling for the wicked half-moon of the axe. His hands opened and closed uncertainly on the thick haft. It was a weapon, but neither his hidden practice behind the forge nor Lan's teaching had really prepared him to use it as one. Even the battle before Shadar-Logoth was too vague in his mind to give him any confidence. He could never quite manage that void that Rand in the water talked about, either. Sunlight slanted through the trees behind them, and the forest was a still mass of dappled shadows. The faint smell of wood smoke drifted around them, tinged with the aroma of cooking meat. "It could be rabbit," he thought, and his stomach grumbled. "And it could be something else," he reminded himself. He looked at Egwene. She was watching him. There were responsibilities to being leader. "Wait here," he said softly. She frowned, but he cut her off as she opened her mouth. "And be quiet. We don't know who it is yet." She nodded. Reluctantly, but she did it. Perrin wondered why that did not work when he was trying to make her take his turn riding. Drawing a deep breath, he started for the source of the smoke. He had not spent as much time in the forests around Emmons Field as Rand or Matt, but still he had done his share of hunting rabbits. He crept from tree to tree without so much as snapping a twig. It was not long before he was peering around the bole of a tall oak with spreading serpentine limbs that bent to touch the ground, then rose again. Beyond lay a campfire, and a lean, sun-browned man was leaning against one of the limbs not far from the flames. At least he was not a Trolloc, but he was the strangest fellow Perrin had ever seen. For one thing, his clothes all seemed to be made from animal skins, with the fur still on. Even his boots and the odd, flat-topped round cap on his head. His cloak was a crazy quilt of rabbit and squirrel. His trousers appeared to be made from the long-haired hide of a brown and white goat. Gathered at the back of his neck with a cord, his graying brown hair hung to his waist. A thick beard fanned across half his chest. A long knife hung at his belt, almost a sword, and a bow and quiver stood propped against a limb close to hand. The man leaned back with his eyes closed, apparently asleep, but Perrin did not stir from his concealment. 6 sticks slanted over the fellow's fire, and on each stick a rabbit was skewered, roasted brown, and now and then dripping juice that hissed in the flames. The smell of them, so close, made his mouth water. "You're done drooling." The man opened one eye and cocked it at Perrin's hiding place. "You and your friend might as well sit and have a bite.
I haven't seen you eat much the last couple of days.
Perrin hesitated, then stood slowly, still gripping his axe tightly.
You've been watching me for 2 days?
The man chuckled deep in his throat.
Yes, I've been watching you. And that pretty girl pushes you around like a bantam rooster, doesn't she? Heard you mostly. The horse is the only one of you doesn't trample around loud enough to be heard 5 miles off. You going to ask her in? Or are you intending to eat all the rabbit yourself?
Perrin bristled. He knew he did not make much noise. You could not get close enough to a rabbit in the waterwood to fetch it with a sling if you made noise. But the smell of rabbit made him remember that Egwene was hungry too, not to mention waiting to discover if it was a trollic fire they had smelled. He slipped the haft of his axe through the belt loop and raised his voice.
Egwene, it's all right. It is rabbit.
Offering his hand, he added in a more normal tone,
My name is Perrin. Perrin Ibarra.
The man considered his hand before taking it awkwardly, as if unused to shaking hands.
I'm called Elias, he said, looking up. Elias Machira.
Perrin gasped and nearly dropped Elias's hand. The man's eyes were yellow, like bright polished gold. Some memory tickled at the back of Perrin's mind, then fled. All he could think of right then was that all of the Trolloc's eyes he had seen had been almost black. Egwene appeared, cautiously leading Bella. She tied the mare's reins to one of the smaller branches of the yoke and made polite sounds when Perrin introduced her to Elias, but her eyes kept drifting to the rabbits. She did not seem to notice the man's eyes. When Elias motioned them to the food, she fell to with a will. Perrin hesitated only a minute longer before joining her. Elias waited silently while they ate. Perrin was so hungry he tore off pieces of meat so hot he had to juggle them from hand to hand before he could hold them in his mouth. Even Egwene showed little of her usual neatness. Greasy juice ran down her chin. Day faded into twilight before they began to slow down, moonless darkness closing in around the fire, and then Elias spoke.
What are you doing out here? There isn't a house inside 50 miles in any direction.
We're going to Camelin, Egwene said. Perhaps you could...
Her eyes lifted coolly as Elias threw back his head and roared with laughter. Perrin stared at him, a rabbit leg half raised to his mouth.
Camelin!
Elias wheezed when he could talk again.
The path you were following, the line you've taken the last 2 days... You'll pass 100 miles or more north of Camelin.
We were going to ask directions, Egwene said defensively. We just haven't found any villages or farms yet.
And none you will, Elias said, chuckling. The way you're going, you can travel all the way to the spine of the world without seeing another human. Of course, if you manage to climb the spine, it can be done, some places... You could find people in the Aiel Waste, but you wouldn't like it there. You'd broil by day and freeze by night and die of thirst any time. It takes an Aielman to find water in the waste. And they don't like strangers much. No, not much, I'd say.
He set off into another more furious burst of laughter, this time actually rolling on the ground.
Not much at all, he managed.
Perrin shifted uneasily. Are we eating with a madman? Egwene frowned, but she waited until Elias's mirth faded a little, then said,
Perhaps you could show us the way. You seem to know a good deal more about where places are than we do.
Elias stopped laughing. Raising his head, he replaced his round fur cap, which had fallen off while he was rolling about, and stared at her from under lowered brows.
"I don't much like people," he said in a flat voice. "Cities are full of people. I don't go near villages or even farms very often. Villagers, farmers, they don't like my friends. I wouldn't even have helped you if you hadn't been stumbling around as helpless and innocent as newborn cubs.
But at least you can tell us which way to go, she insisted. If you direct us to the nearest village, even if it's 50 miles away, surely they'll give us directions to Camelin.
Be still, Elias said. My friends are coming.
Bella suddenly whinnied in fear and began jerking to pull her reins free. Perrin half rose as shapes appeared all around them in the darkening forest. Bella reared and twisted, screaming.
Quiet the mare, Elias said. They won't hurt her. Or you, if you're still.
4 wolves stepped into the firelight, shaggy, waist-high forms, with jaws that could break a man's leg. As if the people were not there, they walked up to the fire and laid down between the humans. In the darkness among the trees, firelight reflected off the eyes of more wolves, on all sides.
Yellow eyes, Perrin thought, like Elias's. That was what he had been trying to remember.
Carefully watching the wolves among them, he reached for his axe.
I would not do that, Elias said. If they think you mean harm, they'll stop being friendly.
They were staring at him, those 4 wolves, Perrin saw. He had the feeling that all the wolves, those in the trees as well, were staring at him. It made his skin itch. Cautiously, he moved his hands away from the axe. He imagined he could feel the tension ease among the wolves. Slowly, he sat back down. His hands shook until he gripped his knees to stop them. Egwene was so stiff she almost quivered. One wolf, close to black with a lighter gray patch on his face, lay nearly touching her. Bella had ceased her screaming and rearing. Instead, she stood trembling and shifting in an attempt to keep all of the wolves in view, kicking occasionally to show the wolves that she could, intending to sell her life dearly. The wolves seemed to ignore her and everyone else. Tongues lolling out of their mouths, they waited at their ease.
There, Elias said. That's better.
Are they tame?
Egwene asked faintly, and hopefully, too.
They're pets?
Elias snorted.
Wolves don't tame, girl. Not even as well as men. They're my friends. We keep each other company. Hunt together, converse, after a fashion. Just like any friends. Isn't that right, Dapple?
A wolf with fur that faded through 12 shades of gray, dark and light, turned her head to look at him.
You talk to them?
Perrin marveled.
It isn't exactly talking, Elias replied slowly. The words don't matter, and they aren't exactly right either. Her name isn't Dapple. It's something that means the way shadows play on a forest pool at a midwinter dawn, with the breeze rippling the surface, and the tang of ice when the water touches the tongue, and a hint of snow before nightfall in the air. But that isn't quite it either.
You can't say it in words. It's more of a feeling. That's the way wolves talk. The others are Burn, Hopper, and Wind.
Burn had an old scar on his shoulder that might explain his name, but there was nothing about the other 2 wolves to give any indication of what their names might mean. For all the man's gruffness, Perrin thought Elias was pleased to have the chance to talk to another human. He seemed eager enough to do it, at least. Perrin eyed the wolf's teeth glistening in the firelight and thought it might be a good idea to keep him talking.
How did you learn to talk to wolves, Elias?
They found out, Elias replied. I didn't. Not at first. That's always the way of it, I understand. The wolves find you, not you them. Some people thought me touched by the Dark One, because wolves started appearing wherever I went. I suppose I thought so too, sometimes. Most decent folk began to avoid me, and the ones who sought me out weren't the kind I wanted to know one way or another. Then I noticed there were times when the wolves seemed to know what I was thinking, to respond to what was in my head.
That was the real beginning. They were curious about me. Wolves can sense people usually, but not like this. They were glad to find me. They say it's been a long time since they hunted with men. And when they say a long time, the feeling I get is like a cold wind howling all the way down from the first day.
I never heard of men hunting with wolves, Egwene said. Her voice was not entirely steady, but the fact that the wolves were just lying there seemed to give her heart.
If Elias heard her, he gave no sign. Wolves remember things differently from the way people do, he said. His strange eyes took on a faraway look, as if he were drifting off on the flow of memory himself. Every wolf remembers the history of all wolves, or at least the shape of it. Like I said, it can't be put into words very well. They remember running down prey side by side with men. But it was so long ago that it's more like the shadow of a shadow than a memory.
That's very interesting, Egwene said, and Elias looked at her sharply. No, I mean it. It is.
She wet her lips.
Could you teach us to talk to them?
Elias snorted again. It can't be taught. Some can do it, some can't. They say he can. He pointed at Perrin. Perrin looked at Elias's finger as if it were a knife.
He really is a madman.
The wolves were staring at him again. He shifted uncomfortably. You say you're going to Camelin, Elias said. But that still doesn't explain what you're doing out here, days from anywhere. He tossed back his fur-patched cloak and lay down on his side, propped on one elbow and waiting expectantly. Perrin glanced at Egwene. Early on, they concocted a story for when they found people to explain where they were going without bringing them any trouble, without letting anyone know where they were really from or where they were really going, eventually. Who knew what careless word might reach a fade's ear? They had worked on it every day, patching it together, honing out flaws. And they had decided Egwene was the one to tell it. She was better with words than he was, and she claimed she could always tell when he was lying by his face. Egwene began at once, smoothly. They were from the north, from Saldea, from farms outside a tiny village. Neither of them had been more than 20 miles from home in their whole lives before this. But they had heard Gleeman's stories and merchants' tales, and they wanted to see some of the world. Camelin and Ilion. The Sea of Storms, and maybe even the fabled islands of the Sea Folk. Perrin listened with satisfaction. Not even Tom Marilyn could have made a better tale from the little they knew of the world outside the two rivers, or one better suited to their needs.
From Saldea, eh? Elias said when she was done.
Perrin nodded. That's right. We thought about seeing Maradon first. I'd surely like to see the king. But the capital city would be the first place our fathers would look.
That was his part of it. To make it plain, they had never been to Maradon. That way no one would expect them to know anything about the city, just in case they ran into someone who really had been there. It was all a long way from Emmons Field and the events of Winter Night. Nobody hearing the tale would have any reason to think of Tar Valon or Aes Sedai.
Quite a story, Elias nodded. Yes, quite a story. There's a few things wrong with it, but the main thing is, Dapple says it's all a lump of lies. Every last word.
Lies! Egwene exclaimed. Why would we lie?
The four wolves had not moved, but they no longer seemed to be just lying there around the fire. They crouched instead, and their yellow eyes watched the Emmons Fielders without blinking. Perrin did not say anything, but his hand strayed to the axe at his waist. The four wolves rose to their feet in one quick movement, and his hand froze. They made no sound, but the thick hackles on their necks stood erect. One of the wolves, back under the trees, raised a growling howl into the night. Others answered. 5, 10, 20, till the darkness rippled with them. Abruptly, they too were still. Cold sweat trickled down Perrin's face.
If you think...
Egwene stopped to swallow.
Despite the chill in the air, there was sweat on her face, too.
If you think we're lying, then you'll probably prefer that we make our own camp for the night away from yours.
Ordinarily I would, girl. But right now I want to know about the Trollocs and the Half-Men.
Perrin struggled to keep his face impassive and hoped he was doing better at it than Egwene. Elias went on in a conversational tone.
Dapple says she smelled Half-Men and Trollocs in your minds while you were telling that fool story. They all did. You're mixed up with Trollocs somehow, and the Eyeless. Wolves hate Trollocs and Half-Men worse than wildfire, worse than anything. And so do I. Byrne wants to be done with you. It was Trollocs gave him that mark when he was a yearling. He says game is scarce and you're fatter than any deer he's seen in months, and we should be done with you. But Byrne is always impatient. Why don't you tell me about it? I hope you're not dark friends. I don't like killing people after I've fed them. Just remember, they'll know if you lie. And even Dapple is already near as upset as Byrne. His eyes, as yellow as the wolf's eyes, blinked no more than theirs did.
They are a wolf's eyes, Perrin thought.
Egwene was looking at him, he realized, waiting for him to decide what they should do.
Light, suddenly I'm the leader again.
They had decided from the first that they could not risk telling the real story to anyone, but he saw no chance for them to get away, even if he managed to get his axe out before. Dapple growled deep in her throat, and the sound was taken up by the other three around the fire, then by the wolves in the darkness. The menacing rumble filled the night.
All right,
Perrin said quickly.
All right.
The growling cut off, sharp and sudden. Egwene unclenched her hands and nodded.
It all started a few days before winter night, Perrin began, when our friend Matt saw a man in a black cloak.
Elias never changed his expression or the way he lay on his side, but there was something about the tilt of his head that spoke of ears pricking up. The four wolves sat down as Perrin went on. He had the impression they were listening, too. The story was a long one, and he told almost all of it. The dream he and the others had had in Bearlawn, though, he kept to himself. He waited for the wolves to make some sign that they had caught the omission, but they only watched. Dapple seemed friendly, Byrne angry. He was hoarse by the time he finished.
And if she doesn't find us in Camelin, we'll go on to Tar Valon. We don't have any choice except to get help from the Aes Sedai.
Trollocs and Half-Men is far south, Elias mused. Now that's something to consider.
He rooted behind him and tossed Perrin a hide water bag, not really looking at him. He appeared to be thinking. He waited until Perrin had drunk and replaced the plug before he spoke again.
I don't hold with Aes Sedai. The Red Aja, those that like hunting for men who mess with the One Power, they wanted to gentle me once. I told them to their faces they were Black Aja. Serve the Dark One, I said. And they didn't like that at all. They couldn't catch me, though, once I got into the forest. But they did try. Yes, they did. Come to that, I doubt any Aes Sedai would take kindly to me after that. I had to kill a couple of warders. Bad business, that, killing warders. Don't like it.
This talking to wolves, Perrin said uneasily. It has to do with the power?
Of course not, Elias growled. Wouldn't have worked on me, gentling, but it made me mad, them wanting to try. This is an old thing, boy. Older than Aes Sedai. Older than anybody using the One Power. Old as humankind. Old as wolves. They don't like that either, Aes Sedai. Old things coming again. I'm not the only one. There are other things, other folk. Makes Aes Sedai nervous. Makes them mutter about ancient barriers weakening. Things are breaking apart, they say. They're afraid the Dark One will get loose, is what. You'd think I was to blame the way some of them looked at me. Red Aja, anyway. But some others, too. The Ammerlin Seat. Yah! I keep clear of them, mostly. and clear friends of Aes Sedai as well. You will, too, if you're smart.
I'd like nothing better than to stay away from Aes Sedai, Perrin said. Egwene gave him a sharp look. He hoped she would not burst out that she wanted to be an Aes Sedai. But she said nothing, though her mouth tightened and Perrin went on. It isn't as if we have a choice. We've had Trollocs chasing us and Fades and Drakkar. Everything but Dark Friends. We can't hide and we can't fight back alone. So who is going to help us? Who else is strong enough except Aes Sedai?
Elias was silent for a time, looking at the wolves, most often at Dapple or Burn. Perrin shifted nervously and tried not to watch. When he watched, he had the feeling that he could almost hear what Elias and the wolves were saying to one another.
Even if it had nothing to do with the power, he wanted no part of it. He had to be making some crazy joke. I can't talk to wolves.
One of the wolves, Hopper, he thought, looked at him and seemed to grin. He wondered how he had put a name to him.
You could stay with me, Elias said finally. With us.
Egwene's eyebrows shot up and Perrin's mouth dropped open.
Well, what could be safer? Elias challenged. Trollocs will take any chance they get to kill a wolf by itself, but they'll go miles out of their way to avoid a pack. And you won't have to worry about Aes Sedai either. They don't often come into these woods.
I don't know.
Perrin avoided looking at the wolves to either side of him. One was Dapple, and he could feel her eyes on him.
For one thing, it isn't just the Trollocs.
Elias chuckled coldly.
I've seen a pack pull down one of the Eyeless, too. Lost half the pack, but they wouldn't give up once they had it sent. Trollocs, Murdral, it's all one to the wolves. It's you they really want, boy. They've heard of other men who can talk to wolves, but you're the first they've ever met besides me. They'll accept your friend, too, though, and you'll all be safer here than in any city. There's dark friends in cities.
Listen, Perrin said urgently. I wish you'd stop saying that. I can't do that. What you do, what you're saying.
As you wish, boy. Play the goat if you've a mind to. Don't you want to be safe?
I am not deceiving myself. There's nothing to deceive myself about. All we want... We are going to Caemlyn, Egwene spoke up firmly, and then to Tar Valon.
Closing his mouth, Perrin met her angry look with one of his own. He knew that she followed his lead when she wanted to, and not when she did not. But she could at least let him answer for himself.
What about you, Perrin?
He said, and answered himself.
Me? Well, let me think. Yes, yes, I think I'll go on.
He turned a mild smile on her.
Well, Egwene, that makes both of us. I guess I'm going with you at that. Good to talk these things out before making a decision, isn't it?
She blushed, but the set of her jaw never lessened. Elias grunted.
Dapple said that's what you'd decide. She said the girl's planted firmly in the human world, while you, he nodded to Perrin, stand halfway between. Under the circumstances, I suppose we'd better go south with you. Otherwise, you'll probably starve to death or get lost or...
Abruptly, Byrne stood up, and Elias turned his head to regard the big wolf. After a moment, Dapple rose, too. She moved closer to Elias so that she also was meeting Byrne's stare. The tableau was frozen for long minutes. Then Byrne whirled and vanished into the night. Dapple shook herself, then resumed her place, flopping down as if nothing had happened. Elias met Perrin's questioning eyes.
"Dapple runs this pack," he explained. "Some of the males could best her if they challenged, but she's smarter than any of them, and they all know it. She's saved the pack more than once. But Byrne thinks the pack is wasting time with you three. Hating Trollocs is about all there is to him. And if there are Trollocs this far south, he wants to be off killing them.
We quite understand, Egwene said, sounding relieved. We really can find our own way. With some directions, of course, if you'll give them.
Elias waved a hand. I said Dapple leads this pack, didn't I? In the morning, I'll start south with you, and so will they.
Egwene looked as if that was not the best news she could have heard. Perrin sat wrapped in his own silence. He could feel Byrne leaving. And the scarred male was not the only one. A dozen others, all young males, loped after him. He wanted to believe it was all Elias playing in his imagination, but he could not. Just before the departing wolves faded from his mind, he felt a thought he knew came from Byrne, as sharp and clear as if it were his own thought. Hatred. Hatred and the taste of blood.
Chapter 24. Flight down the Aranel.
Water dripped in the distance, hollow splashes echoing and re-echoing, losing their source forever. There were stone bridges and railless ramps everywhere, all sprouting off from broad, flat-topped stone spires, all polished and smooth and streaked with red and gold. Level on level, the maze stretched up and down through the murk, without any apparent beginning or end. Every bridge led to a spire, every ramp to another spire, other bridges. Whatever direction Rand looked, as far as his eye could make out in the dimness, it was the same, above as well as below. There was not enough light to see clearly, and he was almost glad of it. Some of those ramps led to platforms that had to be directly above the ones below. He could not see the base of any of them. He pressed, seeking freedom, knowing it was an illusion. Everything was illusion. He knew the illusion. He had followed it too many times not to know. However far he went, up or down, or in any direction, there was only the shiny stone. Stone. But the dankness of deep, fresh-turned earth permeated the air, and the sickly sweetness of decay. The smell of a grave opened out of its time. He tried not to breathe, but the smell filled his nostrils. It clung to his skin like oil. A flicker of motion caught his eye, and he froze where he was, half crouched against the polished guard wall around one of the spire tops. It was no hiding place. From 1,000 places a watcher could have seen him. Shadow filled the air, but there were no deeper shadows in which to hide. The light did not come from lamps or lanterns or torches. It was simply there, such as it was, as if it seeped out of the air. Enough by which to see, after a fashion. Enough by which to be seen. But stillness gave a little protection. The movement came again, and now it was clear. A man striding up a distant ramp, careless of the lack of railings and the drop to nothing below. The man's cloak rippled with his stately haste, and his head turned, searching, searching. The distance was too far for Rand to see more than the shape in the murk, but he did not need to be closer to know the cloak was the red of fresh blood, that the searching eyes blazed like two furnaces. He tried tracing the maze with his eyes to see how many connections Baalzamun needed before reaching him, then gave it up as useless. Distances were deceiving here, another lesson he had learned. What seemed far away might be reached by turning a corner. What appeared close could be out of reach altogether. The only thing to do, as it had been from the beginning, was to keep moving. Keep moving and not think. Thinking was dangerous, he knew. Yet, as he turned away from Baalzamun's distant form, he could not help wondering about Matt. Was Matt somewhere in this maze? Or are there two mazes, two Baalzamuns? His mind skittered away from that. It was too dreadful to dwell on. Is this like Bearlon? Then why can't he find me? That was a little better. A small comfort. Comfort? Blood and ashes, where's the comfort in it? There had been two or three close brushes, though he could not remember them clearly, but for a long, long time. How long? He had run while Baalzamun vainly pursued. Was this like Bearlon? Or was it only a nightmare, only a dream like other men's dreams? For an instant, then, just for the length of time it took to take a breath, he knew why it was dangerous to think, what it was dangerous to think about. As it had before, every time he allowed himself to think of what surrounded him as a dream, the air shimmered, clouding his eyes. It turned to gel, holding him. just for an instant. The gritty heat prickled his skin, and his throat had long since gone dry as he trotted down the thorn hedge maze. How long had it been now? His sweat evaporated before it had a chance to bead, and his eyes burned. Overhead, and not too far overhead at that, boiled furious, steely clouds streaked with black, but not a breath of air stirred in the maze. For a moment he thought it had been different, but the thought evaporated in the heat. He had been here a long time. It was dangerous to think, he knew that. Smooth stones, pale and rounded, made a sketchy pavement, half buried in the bone-dry dust that rose in puffs at even his lightest step. It tickled his nose, threatening a sneeze that might give him away. When he tried to breathe through his mouth, dust clogged his throat until he choked. This was a dangerous place, he knew that too. Ahead of him, he could see three openings in the high wall of thorns, then the way curved out of sight. Balsamon could be approaching any one of those corners at that very moment. There had been two or three encounters already, though he could not remember much beyond that they had happened and that he had escaped. Somehow. Dangerous to think too much. Panting in the heat, he stopped to examine the maze wall. Thickly woven thorn bushes, brown and dead-looking, with cruel black thorns like inch-long hooks. Too tall to see over, too dense to see through. Gingerly he touched the wall and gasped. Despite all his care, a thorn pierced his finger, burning like a hot needle. He stumbled back, his heels catching on the stones, shaking his head and scattering thick drops of blood. The burn began to subside, but his whole hand throbbed. Abruptly he forgot the pain. His heel had overturned one of the smooth stones, kicked it out of the dry ground. He stared at it, and empty eye sockets stared back. A skull. A human skull. He looked along the pathway at all the smooth, pale stones, all exactly alike. He shifted his feet hastily, but he could not move without walking on them, and he could not stay still without standing on them. A stray thought took vague shape that things might not be what they seemed, but he pushed it down ruthlessly. Thinking was dangerous here. He took a shaky hold on himself. Staying in one place was dangerous, too. That was one of the things he knew dimly, but with certainty. The flow of blood from his finger had dwindled to a slow drip, and the throb was almost gone. Sucking his fingertip, he started down the path in the direction he happened to be facing. One way was as good as another in here. Now he remembered hearing once that you could get out of a maze by always turning in the same direction. At the first opening in the wall of thorns, he turned right, then right again at the next, and found himself face to face with Balsamon. Surprise flitted across Balsamon's face, and his blood-red cloak settled as he stopped short. Flames soared in his eyes, but in the heat of the maze, Rand barely felt them.
"How long do you think you can evade me, boy? How long do you think you can evade your fate? You are mine!"
Stumbling back, Rand wondered why he was fumbling at his belt as if for a sword.
"Light, help me," he muttered. "Light, help me."
He could not remember what it meant.
"The light will not help you, boy, and the eye of the world will not serve you. You are my hound, and if you will not course at my command, I will strangle you with the corpse of the great serpent."
Balsamon stretched out his hand, and suddenly Rand knew a way to escape, a misty half-formed memory that screamed danger, but nothing to the danger of being touched by the Dark One.
"A dream!" Rand shouted. "This is a dream!"
Balsamon's eyes began to widen, in surprise or anger or both. Then the air shimmered and his features blurred and faded. Rand turned about in one spot, staring at his own image thrown back at him 1,000-fold, 10,000-fold. Above was blackness and blackness below, but all around him stood mirrors, mirrors set at every angle. Mirrors as far as he could see, all showing him, crouched and turning, staring wide-eyed and frightened. A red blur drifted across the mirrors. He spun, trying to catch it, but in every mirror it drifted behind his own image and vanished. Then it was back again, but not as a blur. Balsamon strode across the mirrors, 10,000 Balsamons, searching, crossing and recrossing the silvery mirrors.
He found himself staring at the reflection of his own face, pale and shivering in the knife-edge cold. Balsamon's image grew behind his, staring at him. Not seeing, but staring still. In every mirror, the flames of Balsamon's face raged behind him, enveloping, consuming, merging. He wanted to scream, but his throat was frozen. There was only one face in those endless mirrors. His own face. Balsamon's face. One face. Rand jerked and opened his eyes. Darkness lessened only slightly by a pale light. Barely breathing, he moved nothing except his eyes. A rough wool blanket covered him to his shoulders, and his head was cradled on his arms. He could feel smooth wooden planks beneath his hands. Deck planks. Rigging creaked in the night. He let out a long breath. He was on the spray. It was over. For another night, at least. Without thinking, he put his finger in his mouth. At the taste of blood, he stopped breathing. Slowly he put his hand close to his face, to where he could see in the dim moonlight, to where he could watch the bead of blood form on his fingertip. Blood from the prick of a thorn. The spray made haste slowly down the Arunel. The wind came strong, but from directions that made the sails useless. With all Captain Doman's demand for speed, the vessel crept along. By night, a man in the bows cast a tallowed lead by lantern light, calling back the depth to the steersman, while the current carried her downriver against the wind with the sweeps pulled in. There were no rocks to fear in the Arunel, but shallows and shoals there were aplenty, where a boat could go hard aground to remain, bows and more, dug into the mud, until help came. If it was help that came first. By day the sweeps worked from sunrise to sunset, but the wind fought them as if it wanted to push the boat back upriver. They did not put into shore, neither by day nor by night. Bale Doman drove boat and crew alike hard, railing at the contrary winds, cursing the slow pace. He blistered the crew for sluggards at the oars and flayed them with his tongue for every mishandled line, his low, hard voice painting Trollocs 10 feet tall among them on the deck, ripping out their throats. For 2 days that was enough to send every man leaping. Then the shock of the Trolloc attack began to fade, and men began to mutter about an hour to stretch their legs ashore, and about the dangers of running downriver in the dark. The crew kept their grumbles quiet, watching out of the corners of their eyes to make sure Captain Doman was not close enough to hear, but he seemed to hear everything said on his boat. Each time the grumblings began, he silently brought out the long, scythe-like sword and cruelly hooked axe that had been found on the deck after the attack. He would hang them on the mast for an hour, and those who had been wounded would finger their bandages, and the mutterings quieted. For a day or so, at least, until one or another of the crew began thinking once more that surely they had left the Trollocs far behind by now, and the cycle began yet again. Rand noticed that Tom Marilyn stayed clear of the crew when they began whispering together and frowning, though usually he was slapping backs and telling jokes and exchanging banter in a way that put a grin on even the hardest-working man. Tom watched those secretive mutters with a wary eye while appearing to be absorbed in lighting his long-stemmed pipe or tuning his harp, or almost anything except paying any mind at all to the crew. Rand did not understand why. It was not the three who had come aboard chased by Trollocs whom the crew seemed to blame, but rather Florin Gelb. For the first day or two, Gelb's wiry figure could almost always be found addressing any crewman he could corner, telling his version of the night Rand and the others came on board. Gelb's manner slid from bluster to whines and back again, and his lip always curled when he pointed to Tom or Matt, or especially Rand, trying to lay the blame on them.
"They're strangers," Gelb pleaded, quietly and with an eye out for the captain. "What do we know of them? The Trollocs came with them. That's what we know. They're in league."
"Fortune, Gelb, stow it," growled a man with his hair in a pigtail and a small blue star tattooed on his cheek.
He did not look at Gelb as he coiled a line on deck, working it in with his bare toes. All the sailors went barefoot despite the cold. Boots could slip on a wet deck.
You'd call your mother dark friend if it had let you slack. Get away from me.
He spat on Gelb's foot and went back to the line. All the crew remembered the watch Gelb had not kept, and the pigtailed man's was the politest response he got. No one even wanted to work with him. Gelb found himself relegated to solitary tasks, all of them filthy, such as scrubbing the galley's greasy pots or crawling into the bilges on his belly to search for leaks among years of slime. Soon he stopped talking to anyone. His shoulders took on a defensive hunch, and injured silence became his stance. The more people watching, the more injured, though it earned him no more than a grunt. When Gelb's eyes fell on Rand, however, or on Matter Tom, murder flashed across his long-nosed face. When Rand mentioned to Matt that Gelb would cause them trouble sooner or later, Matt looked around the boat, saying,
"Can't we trust any of them? Any at all?"
Then he went off to find a place where he could be alone, or as alone as he could get, on a boat less than 30 paces from its raised bow to the sternpost, where the steering oars were mounted. Matt had spent too much time alone since the night at Shadar Logoth, brooding, as Rand saw it. Tom said,
"Trouble won't come from Gelb, boy, if it comes. Not yet, at least. None of the crew will back him, and he hasn't the nerve to try anything alone. But the others now. Doman almost seems to think the Trollocs are chasing him personally, but the rest are beginning to think the danger is past. They might just decide they have had enough. They're on the edge of it as it is."
He hitched his patch-covered cloak, and Rand had the feeling he was checking his hidden knives, his second-best set.
"If they mutiny, boy, they won't leave passengers behind to tell the tale. The Queen's writ might not have much force this far from Camelin, but even a village mayor will do something about that."
That was when Rand, too, began trying not to be noticed when he watched the crewmen. Tom did his part in diverting the crew from thoughts of mutiny. He told stories with all the flourishes, every morning and every night, and in between he played any song they requested. To support the notion that Rand and Matt wanted to be apprentice gleemen, he set aside a time each day for lessons, and that was an entertainment for the crew as well. He would not let either of them touch his harp, of course, and their sessions with the flute produced pained winces in the beginning, at least, and laughter from the crew even while they were covering their ears. He taught the boys some of the easier stories, a little simple tumbling, and of course juggling. Matt complained about what Tom demanded of them, but Tom blew out his mustaches and glared right back.
"I don't know how to play a teaching, boy. I either teach a thing or I don't. Now, even a country bumpkin ought to be able to do a simple handstand. Up you go."
Crewmen, who were not working, always gathered, squatting in a circle around the three. Some even tried their hand at the lessons Tom taught, laughing at their own fumblings. Gelb stood alone and watched it all darkly, hating them all. A good part of each day Rand spent leaning on the railing, staring at the shore. It was not that he really expected to see Egwene or any of the others suddenly appear on the riverbank, but the boat traveled so slowly that he sometimes hoped for it. They could catch up without riding too hard, if they had escaped, if they were still alive. The river rolled on without any sign of life, nor any boat to be seen except the spray. But that was not to say there was nothing to see and wonder at. In the middle of the first day, the R&L ran between high bluffs that stretched for half a mile on either side. For that whole length, the stone had been cut into figures, men and women 100 feet tall, with crowns proclaiming them kings and queens. No two were alike in that royal procession, and long years separated the first from the last. Wind and rain had worn those at the north end smooth, and almost featureless, with faces and details becoming more distinct as they went south. The river lapped around the statue's feet washed to smooth nubs, those that were not gone completely.
How long have they stood there? Rand wondered. How long for the river to wear away so much stone?
None of the crew so much as looked up from their work. They had seen the ancient carving so many times before. Another time, when the eastward shore had become flat grassland again, broken only occasionally by thickets, the sun glinted off something in the distance.
"What can that be?" Rand wondered aloud. It looks like metal.
Captain Doman was walking by, and he paused, squinting toward the glint.
It do be metal, he said.
His words still ran together, but Rand had come to understand without having to puzzle it out.
A tower of metal. I've seen it up close, and I know. River traders use it as a marker. We be 10 days from Whitebridge at the rate we go.
A metal tower? Rand said, and Matt, sitting cross-legged with his back against a barrel, roused from his brooding to listen. The captain nodded.
Aye, shining steel by the look and feel of it, but no a spot of rust. 200 feet high it be, as big around as a house, with no a mark on it and never an opening to be found.
I'll bet there's treasure inside, Matt said.
He stood up and stared toward the far tower as the river carried the spray beyond it.
A thing like that must have been made to protect something valuable.
Mayhap, lad, the captain rumbled. There be stranger things in the world than this, though. On Tremulking, one of the sea folk's isles, there be a stone hand 50 feet high sticking out of a hill, clutching a crystal sphere as big as this vessel. There be treasure under that hill if there be treasure anywhere. But the island people want no part of digging there, and the sea folk care for naught but sailing their ships and searching for the Coramoor, their chosen one.
I dig, Matt said. How far is this Tremulking?
A clump of trees slid in front of the shining tower, but he stared as if he could see it yet. Captain Doman shook his head.
No, lad. It no be the treasure that makes for seeing the world. If you find yourself a fistful of gold or some dead king's jewels, all well and good. But it be the strangeness, you see, that pulls you to the next horizon. In Tantico, that be a port on the Arith Ocean. Part of the Ponarch's palace were built in the Age of Legend, so it be said. There be a wall there, where the free, showing animals no man living has ever seen.
Any child can draw an animal nobody's ever seen, Rand said, and the captain chuckled.
Aye, lad, so they can. But can a child make the bones of those animals? In Tonchico they have them, all fastened together like the animal was. They stand in a part of the Ponarch's palace, where any can enter and see. The breaking left 1,000 wonders behind, and there have been 6 empires or more since, some rivaling Arthur Hawkwing's, every one leaving things to see and find. Light sticks and razor lace and heartstone, a crystal lattice covering an island, and it hums when the moon is up. A mountain hollowed into a bowl, and in its center a silver spike 100 spans high, and any who comes within a mile of it dies. Rusted ruins and broken bits, and things found in the bottom of the sea, things not even the oldest books know the meaning of. I've gathered a few myself, things you never dreamed of in more places than you can see in 10 lifetimes. That be the strangeness that will draw you on.
We used to dig up bones in the sand hills, Rand said slowly. Strange bones. There was part of a fish, I think it was a fish, as big as this boat once. Some said it was bad luck, digging in the hills.
The captain eyed him shrewdly.
You're thinking about home already, lad, and you just set out in the world? The world will put a hook in your mouth. You'll set off chasing the sunset, you wait and see. And if you ever go back, your village will be no big enough to hold you.
No!
He gave a start. How long had it been since he had thought of home, of Emmons Field? And what of Tam? It had to be days. It felt like months.
I will go home. One day, when I can. I'll raise sheep like my father. And if I never leave again, it will be too soon. Isn't that right, Matt? As soon as we can, we're going home and forget all this even exists.
With a visible effort, Matt pulled away from staring upriver after the vanished tower.
What? Oh. Yes, of course. We'll go home. Of course.
As he turned to go, Rand heard him muttering under his breath.
I'll bet he just doesn't want anybody else going after the treasure.
He did not seem to realize he had spoken aloud. 4 days into their trip downriver found Rand atop the mast, sitting on the blunt end, with his legs wrapped in the stays. The spray rolled gently on the river, but 50 feet above the water, that easy roll made the top of the mast sway back and forth through wide arcs. He threw back his head and laughed into the wind that blew in his face. The oars were out, and from here the boat looked like some 12-legged spider creeping down the Arenal. He had been as high as this before in trees back in the Two Rivers, but this time there were no branches to block his view. Everything on deck, the sailors at the sweeps, men on their knees scrubbing the deck with smooth stones, men doing things with lines and hatch covers, looked so odd when seen from right overhead, all squat and foreshortened, that he had spent an hour just staring at them and chuckling. He still chuckled whenever he looked down at them, but now he was staring at the riverbanks flowing by. That was the way it seemed, as if he were still, except for the swaying back and forth, of course, and the banks slid slowly by, trees and hills marching along to either side. He was still, and the whole world moved past him. On sudden impulse, he unwrapped his legs from the stays bracing the mast and held his arms and legs out to either side, balancing against the sway. For three complete arcs, he kept his balance like that. Then suddenly it was gone. Arms and legs windmilling, he toppled forward and grabbed the forestay. Legs splayed to either side of the mast, nothing holding him to his precarious perch but his two hands on the stay, he laughed. Gulping huge breaths of fresh, cold wind, he laughed with the exhilaration of it.
"Lad!" came Tom's hoarse voice. "Lad! If you're trying to break your fool neck, don't do it by falling on me!"
Rand looked down. Tom clung to the ratlines just below him, staring up the last few feet grimly. Like Rand, the gleeman had left his cloak below.
"Tom!" he said delightedly. "Tom, when did you come up here?"
"When you wouldn't pay any attention to people shouting at you. Burn me, boy. You've got everybody thinking you've gone mad."
He looked down and was surprised to see all the faces staring up at him. Only Matt, sitting cross-legged up in the bows with his back to the mast, was not looking at him. Even the men at the oars had their eyes raised, letting their stroke go ragged, and no one was berating them for it. Rand twisted his head around to look under his arm at the stern. Captain Doman stood by the steering oar, ham-like fists on his hips, glaring at him atop the mast. He turned back to grin at Tom.
"You want me to come down, then?"
Tom nodded vigorously.
"I would appreciate it greatly."
"All right."
Shifting his grip on the forestay, he sprang forward off the mast top. He heard Tom bite off an oath as his fall was cut short, and he dangled from the forestay by his hands. The gleeman scowled at him, one hand half-stretched out to catch him. He grinned at Tom again.
"I'm going down now."
Swinging his legs up, he hooked one knee over the thick line that ran from the mast to the bow, then caught it in the crook of his elbow, and let go with his hands. Slowly, then with increasing speed, he slid down. Just short of the bow, he dropped to his feet on the deck right in front of Matt, took one step to catch his balance, and turned to face the boat with his arms spread wide, the way Tom did after a tumbling trick. Scattered clapping rose from the crew, but he was looking down at Matt in surprise, and at what Matt held, hidden from everybody else by his body. A curved dagger with a gold scabbard worked in strange symbols. Fine gold wire wrapped the hilt, which was capped by a ruby as big as Rand's thumbnail, and the quillons were golden-scaled serpents bearing their fangs. Matt continued to slide the dagger in and out of its sheath for a moment. Still playing with the dagger, he raised his head slowly. His eyes had a faraway look. Suddenly they focused on Rand, and he gave a start and stuffed the dagger under his coat. Rand squatted on his heels with his arms crossed on his knees.
"Where did you get that?"
Matt said nothing, looking quickly to see if anyone else was close by. They were alone, for a wonder.
"You didn't take it from Shadar Logoth, did you?"
Matt stared at him.
"It's your fault, yours and Perrin's. The two of you pulled me away from the treasure, and I had it in my hand. Mordeth didn't give it to me. I took it, so Moraine's warnings about his gifts don't count. You won't tell anybody, Rand. They might try to steal it." "I won't tell anybody," Rand said.
"I think Captain Doman is honest, but I wouldn't put anything past the rest of them, especially Galb."
"Not anybody," Matt insisted. "Not Doman, not Tom, not anybody. We're the only two left from Emmons Field, Rand. We can't afford to trust anybody else."
"They're alive, Matt. Egwene and Perrin, I know they're alive." Matt looked ashamed.
I'll keep your secret, though. Just the two of us. At least we don't have to worry about money now. We can sell it for enough to travel to Tar Valon like kings.
Of course, Matt said after a minute. If we have to. Just don't tell anybody until I say so.
I said I wouldn't. Listen, have you had any more dreams since we came on the boat? Like in Berlon? This is the first chance I've had to ask without six people listening.
Matt turned his head away, giving a sidelong look.
Maybe. What do you mean, maybe? Either you have or you haven't. All right, I have. I don't want to talk about it. I don't even want to think about it. It doesn't do any good.
Before either of them could say more, Tom came striding up the deck, his cloak over his arm. The wind whipped his white hair about, and his long mustaches seemed to bristle.
"I managed to convince the captain you aren't crazy," he announced, "that it was part of your training."
He caught hold of the forestay and shook it.
"That fool stunt of yours, sliding down the rope, helped. But you are lucky you didn't break your fool neck."
Rand's eyes went to the forestay and followed it up to the top of the mast, and as they did, his mouth dropped open. He had slid down that. And he had been sitting on top of... Suddenly he could see himself up there, arms and legs spread wide. He sat down hard and barely caught himself short of ending up flat on his back. Tom was looking at him thoughtfully.
"I didn't know you had such a good head for heights, lad. We might be able to play in Ilion, or Abu Dhar, or even Tyr. People in the big cities in the south like tightrope walkers and slackwire artists."
"We're going to..."
At the last minute, Rand remembered to look around for anyone close enough to overhear. Several of the crew were watching them, including Gelb, glaring as usual, but none could hear what he was saying.
"To Tar Valon," he finished.
Matt shrugged as if it were all the same to him where they went.
"At the moment, lad," Tom said, settling down beside them. "But tomorrow, who knows? That's the way with a gleeman's life."
He took a handful of colored balls from one of his wide sleeves.
"Since I have you down out of the air, we'll work on the triple crossover."
Rand's gaze drifted to the top of the mast and he shivered.
"What's happening to me? Like what?"
He had to find out. He had to get to Tar Valon before he really did go mad. Chapter 25. The Traveling People. Bella walked along placidly under the weak sun, as if the three wolves trotting not far off were only village dogs. But the way she rolled her eyes at them from time to time, showing white all the way around, indicated she felt nothing of the sort. Egwene on the mare's back was just as bad. She watched the wolves constantly from the corner of her eye, and sometimes she twisted in the saddle to look around. Perrin was sure she was hunting for the rest of the pack, though she denied it angrily when he suggested as much, denied being afraid of the wolves that pace them, denied worrying about the rest of the pack or what it was up to. She denied and went right on looking, tied-eyed and wetting her lips uneasily. The rest of the pack was far distant. He could have told her that.
What good, even if she believed me, especially if she did?
He was of no mind to open that basket of snakes until he had to. He did not want to think about how he knew. The fur-clad man loped ahead of them, sometimes looking almost like a wolf himself, and he never looked around when Dapple Hopper and the wind appeared, but he knew too. The Emmons Fielders had wakened at dawn that first morning to find Elias cooking more rabbit and watching them over his full beard without much expression. Except for Dapple, Hopper, and Wind, no wolves were to be seen. In the pale early daylight, deep shade still lingered under the big oak, and the bare trees beyond looked like fingers stripped to the bone.
"They're around," Elias answered when Egwene asked where the rest of the pack had gone. "Close enough to help, if need be. Far enough off to avoid any human trouble we get into. Sooner or later, there's always trouble when there's two humans together. If we need them, they'll be there."
Something tickled the back of Perrin's mind as he ripped free a bite of roast rabbit. A direction vaguely sensed.
"Of course. That's where they..."
The hot juices in his mouth abruptly lost all taste. He picked at the tubers Elias had cooked in the coals, They tasted something like turnips, but his appetite was gone. When they had started out, Egwene insisted that everyone take a turn riding, and Perrin did not even bother to argue.
"First turn is yours," he told her. She nodded. "And then you, Elias."
"My own legs are good enough for me," Elias said. He looked at Bella, and the mare rolled her eyes as if he were one of the wolves. "Besides, I don't think she wants me riding her."
"That's nonsense," Egwene replied firmly. "There is no point in being stubborn about it. The sensible thing is for everybody to ride sometimes. According to you, we have a long way still to go."
"I said no, girl." She took a deep breath, and Perrin was wondering if she would succeed in bullying Elias the way she did him, when he realized she was standing there with her mouth open, not saying a word. Elias was looking at her, just looking, with those yellow wolf's eyes. Egwene stepped back from the raw-boned man and licked her lips, and stepped back again. Before Elias turned away, she had backed all the way to Bella and scrambled up onto the mare's back. As the man turned to lead them south, Perrin thought his grin was a good deal like a wolf's, too. For 3 days they traveled in that manner, walking and riding south and east all day, stopping only when twilight thickened. Elias seemed to scorn the haste of city men, but he did not believe in wasting time when there was somewhere to go. The three wolves were seldom seen. Each night they came to the fire for a time, and sometimes in the day they showed themselves briefly, appearing close at hand when least expected, and vanishing in the same manner. Perrin knew they were out there, though, and where. He knew when they were scouting the path ahead, and when they were watching the back trail. He knew when they left the pack's usual hunting grounds, and Dapple sent the pack back to wait for her. Sometimes the three that remained faded from his mind, but long before they were close enough to see again, he was aware of them returning. Even when the trees dwindled to wide scattered groves separated by great swaths of winter-dead grass, they were as ghosts when they did not want to be seen. But he could have pointed a finger straight at them at any time. He did not know how he knew, and he tried to convince himself that it was just his imagination playing tricks, but it did no good. Just as Elias knew, he knew. He tried not thinking about wolves, but they crept into his thoughts all the same. He had not dreamed about Baalzamon since meeting Elias and the wolves. His dreams, as much as he remembered of them on waking, were of everyday things, just as he might have dreamed at home, before Baerlon, before winter night. Normal dreams, with one addition. In every dream, he remembered there was a point where he straightened from Master Luhan's forge to wipe the sweat from his face, or turned from dancing with the village girls on the green, or lifted his head from a book in front of the fireplace, and whether he was outside or under a roof, there was a wolf close to hand. Always the wolf's back was to him, and always he knew, in the dreams it seemed the normal course of things, even at Osbert Luhan's dinner table, that the wolf's yellow eyes were watching for what might come, guarding against what might come. Only when he was awake did the dreams seem strange. 3 days they journeyed, with Dapple, Hopper, and Wind bringing them rabbits and squirrels, and Elias pointing out plants, few of which Perrin recognized, as good to eat. Once a rabbit burst out, almost from under Bella's hooves. Before Perrin could get a stone in his sling, Elias skewered it with his long knife at 20 paces. Another time Elias brought down a fat pheasant on the wing with his bow. They ate far better than they had when on their own, but Perrin would as soon have gone back on short rations if it had meant different company. He was not sure how Egwene felt, but he would have been willing to go hungry if he could do it without the wolves. 3 days into the afternoon. A stand of trees lay ahead, larger than most they had seen, a good 4 miles across. The sun sat low in the western sky, pushing slanted shadows off to their right, and the wind was picking up. Perrin felt the wolves give over quartering behind them and start forward, not hurrying. They had smelled and seen nothing dangerous. Egwene was taking her turn on Bella. It was time to start looking for a camp for the night, and the big copse would serve the purpose well. As they came close to the trees, 3 mastiffs burst from cover, broad-muzzled dogs as tall as the wolves, and even heavier, teeth bared in loud rumbling snarls. They stopped short as soon as they were in the open, but no more than 30 feet separated them from the three people, and their dark eyes kindled with a killing light. Bella, already on edge from the wolves, whinnied and almost unseated Egwene, but Perrin had his sling whirling around his head in an instant. No need to use the axe on dogs. A stone in the ribs would send the worst dog running. Elias waved a hand at him without taking his eyes from the stiff-legged dogs.
Hist! None of that now.
Perrin gave him a puzzled frown, but let the sling slow its spin and finally fall to his side. Egwene managed to get Bella under control. She and the mare both watched the dogs warily. The mastiff's hackles stood stiff, and their ears were laid back, and their growls sounded like earthquakes. Abruptly, Elias raised one finger shoulder high and whistled, a long, shrill whistle that rose higher and higher and did not end. The growls cut off raggedly. The dogs stepped back, whining and turning their heads as if they wanted to go, but were held. Their eyes remained locked to Elias's finger. Slowly, Elias lowered his hand, and the pitch of his whistle lowered with it. The dogs followed until they lay flat on the ground, their tongues lolling from their mouths. Three tails wagged.
See, Elias said, walking to the dogs. There's no need for weapons.
The mastiffs licked his hands, and he scratched their broad heads and fondled their ears.
They look meaner than they are. They meant to frighten us off, and they wouldn't have bitten unless we tried to go into the trees. Anyway, there's no worry of that now. We can make the next thicket before full dark.
When Perrin looked at Egwene, her mouth was hanging open. He shut his own mouth with a click of teeth. Still patting the dogs, Elias studied the stand of trees.
There'll be Tuatha on here. The traveling people.
They stared at him blankly, and he added, Tinkers.
Tinkers? Perrin exclaimed. I've always wanted to see the Tinkers. They camp across the river from Tarin Ferry sometimes, but they don't come down into the two rivers, as far as I know. I don't know why not.
Egwene sniffed.
Probably because the Tarin Ferry folk are as great thieves as the Tinkers. They'd no doubt end up stealing each other blind. Master Elias, if there really are Tinkers close by, shouldn't we go on? We don't want Bella stolen, and... Well,